Bonjour, good day. Hello everyone, welcome. Merci et bienvenue. My name is Will Stry. I'm the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, otherwise and henceforth today known as MISC. And I feel very privileged to be here today as the Institute celebrates its 20th anniversary.
Il me fait grand plaisir de vous accueillir aujourd'hui au nom de l'Institut alors que l'Institut célèbre son 20th
anniversaire. And we're celebrating with a large public education event, a symposium that we've called Canada Remix, in which we ask the question, how might we remix Canada?
Aujourd'hui, nous avons réuni des Canadiens fascinants de divers milieux, incluant la politique, les arts, l'activisme et les médias, pour poser la question, comment pouvons-nous remixer le Canada?
And we'll be discussing what we need to do to ensure the future development of our democracy. What can we do to improve the quality of our civic life? And we'll be discussing whether we, as Canadians, get the information we need. But before we go any further, there are some people that I want and am delighted to thank. First of all, I want to thank three gentlemen without whom we would not be here today. The first two are MISC's founding co-chairs, Mr. Charles R. Bronfman and Mr. Alex K. Patterson, both of whom are with us here today, and whose wisdom and foresight in founding MISC have sustained the institution for the past 20 years. Gentlemen, thank you. The other gentleman I wish to thank is MISC founding director and Hiram Mills Professor Emeritus Desmond Morton, who is here tonight with his wife Gail Eakin. Desmond's dedication to MISC and its mission have shaped the Institute since its earliest days, and his love for teaching continues to inspire new generations of students at MISC every year, as I witness on a yearly basis. I'd also like to thank Professor Suzanne Morton from the Department of History and Classical Studies, who served as MISC's acting director from January to June of this year while I was away on sabbatical leave, and she did a great deal to organize this event. And, of course, former MISC director Antonio Maione, who is joining us today as a moderator for our second panel discussion. So, in fact, all MISC directors are among us today, but I'd particularly, at this point, like to acknowledge you, Antonio. Where are you? And my thanks to MISC's Board of Trustees, especially our former board co-chairs, Denise Chong and Lily de Grandpré, as well as our new, well, before I name the new ones, I'd like to offer a special thanks to Lily and Denise, who conceived this idea, brought it to fruition, and have been incredible, incredible supporters working hard for MISC for many, many, many years. So. And our new co-chairs of the board, Ann Datsun and Michael Goldblum, both of whom are here today as well. And very importantly, the great team I work with here at MISC for all they have done to make this event possible. Adriana, Petros, Liz, Mercedes, Jessica, Joanne Bilodeau, who is in the principal's office these days, but who has been part of this from the very beginning. So thanks to you.
L'Institut d'études sur le Canada est une institution unique au Canada. Nos étudiants de premier cycle sont hors pair et plusieurs d'entre eux poursuivent des réalisations fantastiques après leur temps avec nous. Nos événements d'éducation publique, comme celui-ci, rassemblent des individus fascinants pour discuter et débattre des grandes questions auxquelles notre pays fait face. Le travail de nos visiteurs et de nos stagiaires postdoctoraux font de nous une institution de recherche de première classe. We've got a lot of content to get to this afternoon, so I'll just end by saying that we're live streaming this event to viewers across Canada and the universe. You can view the link on the front page of your program, and we're also tweeting the entire conference en anglais et en français, and you can follow us using the hashtag Canada Remix, which is you can see on the screen and is on your program as well. And we will be taking audience questions for all of our speakers via Twitter using the Canada Remix hashtag. So please pose your questions there. We've got great events coming up at MISC.
You've got literature available out front, and of course you can see the details for both lectures and other events, both of our upcoming lectures, on our website, www.mcgill.ca/MISC. Without further ado, though, permettez-moi de vous présenter la principale de l'Université McGill, Suzanne Fortier, who will introduce this afternoon's keynote speaker. Principal Fortier, bienvenue.
Merci, professeur Stra. Bonjour et bienvenue à vous tous. Merci d'être venus en grand nombre pour célébrer avec nous le 20e anniversaire de l'Institut des études canadiennes de McGill. Welcome to this very important event and thank you so much for being here for a celebration of the great work that has gone on at MISC for the last 20 years. C'est vraiment un honneur et un privilège pour moi d'être ici, mais aussi d'avoir participé au cours de la dernière année aux activités de MISC et d'avoir pu mieux apprendre le travail exceptionnel qui se fait dans l'Institut. Comme vous savez, outre l'enseignement et la recherche, l'une des grandes forces de l'Institut d'études canadiennes est sa capacité de nouer des liens avec la communauté. Et en fait, MISC conferences and lectures, such as today's symposiums, are important opportunities for open, non-partisan dialogue connecting people from different perspectives and different backgrounds. I would like also to give my words of appreciation for the two co-founders of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, Charles Bruntman and Alec Patterson. Like good parents, they left a very strong DNA identity in MISC, a strong vision that was one of creating an institute that would study our country, that would make sure that these studies would contribute to building the future of our country, and that these studies would be extended to interactions with the broader Canadian society. So merci beaucoup à Charles et Alec pour cette contribution exceptionnelle à l'Institut des études canadiennes et à McGill. Merci. Et sans plus tarder, permettez-moi de vous présenter notre premier invité qui prononcera le discours intitulé « Disaster and Community ». Calgary Mayor Naheed Nanshi grew up in Calgary, but has lived and worked in cities around the world before returning to his hometown. He was Canada's first tenured professor in the field of nonprofit management at the Montreal University's Bissett School of Business, and also an advisor to corporate leaders in Canada and the U.S. During the floods that overwhelmed Calgary in 2013, when the Bow and Elbow rivers overflowed, Mayor Nanshi became a leader for Calgary's citizens in press conferences, in one-on-one meetings with Calgarians, and on social media, where he was dubbed Super Nanshi. Indeed, Mayor Nanshi went for days with little sleep while working to handle the crisis for the benefit of all of the citizens of his city. Mayor Nanshi.
Neil Pomwana, please see the next village. I wish I could be there in person today, but we'll have to deal with technology and you'll have to see my face very, very large. I used to spend my days sitting in front of flags and, you know, talking to computers, so this is fascinating for me. I want to tell you a story about last summer.
a story about a week in my life, a week in the life of our nation, and what that week told us about who we are as a community, what we do, and what makes our community strong. And really, I think it's a story about Canada. It's a story of what we've managed to create here together as Canadians, and what, when we have our partisan battles and our academic arguments, we can never forget about who we are together as a community. So, we'll see if the technology works for us. There we are. June 2013. I am in Ottawa. I am speaking to a number of groups in our nation's capital, particularly to large groups, including many folks from the federal government. And I use my favorite line when I talk about the federal government, which is funnier because it's true. I never really can remember what it is that the federal government does. The last time I said that, someone yelled out in the audience, "The post office." Okay. You know, defense, obviously, and international stuff. But as I tell this story, you will learn that I certainly learned one important thing that the federal government does, and that is when you have a natural disaster, they send in the army. And that is tremendously helpful. But I was in Ottawa, and then I flew to Toronto. Now, when I made it to Toronto, I was picked up at the airport by a very good friend of mine, a woman called Allison Lotz. Allison, by the way, has recently written a book called Tragedy in the Commons. If you haven't read it, you must read it. It's a horror story. It's a frightening horror story about our federal government and about civic engagement in our government. But that night, we weren't talking as academics or as an author and a fan. It actually turned out that I had arranged my trip to Ottawa and Toronto, where I was doing lots of public sessions, to coincide so that I could finish my public sessions on Friday night and then head out to St. Catharines, Ontario for Allison's wedding. And she picked me up from the airport, and I said to her, "Allison, I cannot believe that 3 days before your wedding, you have time to come and pick me up from the airport and take me for dinner." And she said, "Nahid, I cannot believe with your schedule that you actually are able to attend my wedding." And I said, "Allison, nothing on earth could prevent me from attending your wedding." And at that exact moment, upstream of Calgary in a town called Canmore, the rain started to fall. By the way, this spring, Calgary was probably the only place in Canada that did not greet the end of the ridiculous winter we had with unbridled enthusiasm. People were a little bit nervous about what the spring rains might bring. And at that moment, while Calgary was all nervous about another flood, Allison sends me a photo of her brand new baby, Alec. And I said, "Congratulations, except I don't know how I feel about milestones in your life." Luckily, everything worked out fine. The rain began to fall. The next morning, I was giving a breakfast speech. I hate giving breakfast speeches in downtown Toronto. And my chief of staff, who had been traveling with me, and he rarely does, well, he has a terrible habit. And his terrible habit is that he is never present with you in the conversation. Luckily, he's got a giant brain, but you only get half of it at a time, because half of it is with you and the other half is on his mobile device trying to figure out what else is going on in the world. And so he was sitting in the front row at my breakfast speech and never once looked up. He was on his phone the entire time. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm giving a pretty brilliant speech here. You should be paying more attention. And then it occurred to me that it was only 6 o'clock in the morning in Calgary. Who in the world was he talking to? And why did he keep getting up and taking phone calls? And when I finished my speech, he pulled me off to the side and he said, "We have a problem. See, the geography of Calgary is such that our two rivers, the Bow and the Elbow River, which meet just behind City Hall where I'm sitting right now, and yes, I know it's funny that they're called the Bow and Elbow Rivers, are very close to their headwaters. So unlike in a place like Manitoba, where you can see the flood coming and you may have days to prepare, in Calgary you'll never have days to prepare. If the rivers crest at their headwaters, they're within Calgary, they're to Calgary within a matter of hours. And so we knew this was happening. Canmore had already been devastated. The water was on its way to Calgary. And as near as we could figure, the water would be approximately 7 times the size of our last flooding event in 2005. So from that place in Toronto, I declared a state of local emergency. We agreed to evacuate nearly 100,000 people from their homes. We turned off the electrical power to great swaths of the city in preparation for what was about to happen. We protected critical infrastructure and private property with sandbags as best we could. And we waited. Just because of the crowd that I'm talking to, I'll pause and tell you about that state of local emergency for a moment. It was the first time in Calgary's history we'd ever declared such a thing. And it provides the city with extraordinary powers. The power to conscript people into service. The power to set prices. The power to confiscate private property. And just again, because of this crowd, I'll tell you, technically, it's very interesting. When we sign a state of local emergency, those powers devolve to the mayor. And by convention, the mayor immediately signs a second piece of paper devolving those powers to the director of emergency management. Why do we do that? Because the director of emergency management is a civil servant. If he screws up, he can be accountable, he can be fired. I probably don't need to tell people in Montreal that if the mayor screws up, you're stuck with him. Not that your current mayor ever would. So it's a good governance thing, and it really talks about how we work as a community and our government works well, and I'm going to come back to that point in just a moment. But the funny part of all of this is I've got a wonderful staff here, mostly younger people, and my young communications advisor, about a week into the event, said, "This state of local emergency is crazy, Mayor." And I said, "How do you mean?" And he goes, it's just like when they declared the War Measures Act." And I said, "Well, I'm glad you paid attention in your social studies classes, because we did declare the War Measures Act. That's what it's called now." So we're getting something good in Canadian education. Nonetheless, I got to Calgary late on that Thursday night and assessed the damage to the city. I took this picture on Friday. I was in a helicopter. I didn't even have time to think about, ooh, I'm in a helicopter. I wanted to show you this picture for a couple of reasons. Number one is what you're looking at is the Bow River. The Bow River, as I said, is one of two rivers that flow through Calgary. On a normal day in June, the Bow River runs pretty high. It can be at about 200 or 300 cubic meters per second. What you're looking at right now is the Bow River running at nearly 2,200 cubic meters per second. The other river in Calgary, the Elbow River, is controlled by a dam. And so it's very, very placid. One of the favorite things of Calgarians to do in the summer is to get on an air mattress and float down the Elbow River. On a June day, it would normally run at 25 or 30 cubic meters per second. At the time I took this photo, instead of 25 or 30 cubic meters per second, it was running at 700. So on the top of your screen, you see the south bank of the Bow River. That's the community of Bowness. Those beautiful Venetian canals you see used to be roads. Those patches of trees you see, well, those used to be people's houses. But the real reason I show you this picture is not to show you the top of the screen, but actually for you to take a look at the bottom of the screen. That's the north bank of the Bow River, the community of Montgomery. And you'll notice in Montgomery, the streets are dry. There's not a drop of water in the basements. Folks, that's nature. No matter how sophisticated we are, no matter how modern we think we are as a community in our great cities in this nation, that's nature. One side of the Bow River, you're underwater. The other bank of the river, you're high and dry. And these are things that we cannot control. The floods of 2013 in southern Alberta were the most expensive natural disaster in Canadian history. $6 billion+ worth of damage. In the city of Calgary alone, damage to public infrastructure was more than $500 million. To give you some context for that, the $6 billion that we are spending on disaster recovery in southern Alberta would double my rapid transit network. We would double the train network in Calgary. So these are big, huge numbers. Now, we were lucky in one way, and we were lucky that the water receded very, very quickly. This was Friday. By Saturday, we were starting to see what those roads looked like as the water came back and what the damage was. And we came to an interesting question, which was, because the power had been turned off, because there had been damage to the homes, traditional disaster management work would tell you that every single one of those homes needed to be inspected before people could go home. But we also understood the very human need, the very human need for people to see their house, to see what kind of damage was there, to make short and long-term plans for themselves and their families. And we decided that we could rely upon one very important treatise, one very important philosophy that too many governments have forgotten, which is in fact my core political philosophy. People always ask me, are you left-wing or right-wing? What do you stand for? And I always say, I only have one core political philosophy. And my core political philosophy is, people aren't stupid. I know that's kind of shocking for people who follow our provincial and federal governments. Citizens aren't stupid. Citizens can be trusted to join into the conversation, and above all, citizens can be trusted to do the right thing. So that informed all of the communications we did during the flood. I made a simple rule, which was that if we knew something, everyone knew what we knew. Unless there was a compelling public safety reason to hold back information, we never would, and we never did, by the way. So using that same philosophy, we said, you know, people can be trusted to do the right thing. So we said to 35,000 people, you know what, you can go home now. But you need to help us. You need to follow a few basic rules. Don't go straight home. Go to your local community center first. They'll give you a checklist and some supplies. When you get to your street, if there's water on the road, don't go any further. When you get to your house, if there's water on the walkway, don't go any further. When you open your house door, if there's water on the main floor, don't go in. If you're inside your house and you realize that there's evidence that there's been water in the basement above the level of the lowest electrical outlet, don't go any further. And go back to the community center and we'll help you. If all of those things are clear, start the work of cleanup, put a sign in your window that says need heat, need power, need gas, and we will try and get to you as quickly as we can. And in one fell swoop, with one decision, we created 35,000 home inspectors. And people were able to go back to their houses and start to get on with their lives. And there was a lot to get on with. Scenes like this were very common throughout the whole city. And I want you to look at this picture a little bit critically. It looks like a big pile of trash on the lawn in front of someone's house. And I guess that's what it is. A big pile of trash in front of a really nice home in a really nice neighborhood. But when we look more closely, well, that trash, it's your kids' report cards. It's their artwork. It's your family photo albums. It's that couch that you saw in a catalog and you scrimped and saved for because you wanted exactly that couch for your living room. It's your life. And it's your life sitting out on the lawn in full view of the world, waiting for my colleagues who drive the garbage trucks to come and take it away. And to me, that's an important leadership lesson. When you're in a position like I'm in, you make decisions that impact lots of people every day. But you have to remember that every one of those people is a human being with a fully formed life. And the decisions we make impact those lives in every single way, every single day. So, we learned two big lessons out of the flood. And the first lesson is that we are incredibly blessed as Canadians, to live in a place where government works. Where dedicated public servants go to work every single day to keep us safe and to make our communities better. And during this crisis, Man, was I ever reminded of that. As much fun as I make of the other orders of government, the federal government was right there, and particularly the women and men of the Canadian Forces made a huge difference for us. The provincial government did their part with environment, with funding, with Alberta Health Services, and so on. But if I may, I've got 20,000 colleagues at the City of Calgary. They drive buses. They keep our water safe. By the way, the most dangerous job during the flood was at the water treatment plant, which is next to the river. Those people were risking their lives to protect the quality of our water supply. And by the way, we never had a boil water advisory during this flood. My colleagues are first on the scene when there's an emergency, police officers and firefighters, and they build roads, as you can see here. This is a crew of city staff and private contractors working to repair our LRT system. You may have seen pictures of the tracks going into this particular tunnel during the flood. It looked like a roller coaster. The Calgary Stampede was starting exactly 2 weeks later. The train had to be working. They managed to fix the train, the entire track system, and bring it back to life in 1 week. The road they're standing in front of is McLeod Trail, which is a major thoroughfare for the City of Calgary. It had a giant sinkhole in the middle of it. They rebuilt a new McLeod Trail in 1 day. Now, I should say that these construction timelines did lead me to a very important question. If you can fix it in 1 day, the answer they keep coming up with is, we didn't have to do public engagement, Your Worship. Probably more about, we didn't have to worry about the budget as much, Your Worship. But in any case, we were so lucky, and I will tell you one thing. The line that I use when I talk about the flood in Calgary that gets more applause than anything else is when I say, God bless the garbage men. Driving those giant trucks, 16, 17, 18, 19 hours a day, men and women, up and down those flood-impacted streets, just trying to bring a bit of cleanliness, a bit of normalcy back to the community, and how important that work that we never ever think about unless our garbage doesn't get picked up is every single day. But I also know that none of my colleagues in the public service will particularly begrudge me for saying that our job as public service is made so much easier by the quality of the public whom we serve. And that's really what I'm going to spend the rest of my time with you on. When the crisis hit, and I flew back from Toronto, I walked into the Emergency Operations Center of the City of Calgary. Imagine every movie you've ever seen about NASA and what mission control looks like. A wall of video monitors, a million cubicles in front. You can smell the adrenaline, the passion, and the drive. It's like a giant game of whack-a-mole. People are jumping up in their podiums, in their cubicles, saying things like, I need to evacuate a building in Chinatown. And the police will jump up and say, I can have officers there in 5 minutes. And Calgary Transit will jump up and say, I can get a bus there in 10. And emergency social services will jump up and say, it might be hard to get Chinese translators in the middle of the night, but give me a half hour. And someone across the room will jump up and say, I speak Cantonese, let me go. So it's this amazing system, it's government at its absolute best. But very quickly, in the middle of all of that, I started to get calls and tweets and emails from regular Calgarians saying, you know what, Mayor? My basement's dry. I haven't seen a drop of water. Remember, even at its peak, the flood only impacted about 15% of the land area of Calgary. And people would say, my place is dry. What can I do? How can I help? So in the middle of that controlled chaos at the Emergency Operations Center, I pulled aside a few of my colleagues at the City of Calgary and I said, step away from this. Your job is to manage the volunteer response. How are we going to get people who want to help helping? And bless their souls, I do love my colleagues, but sometimes public servants can get a little bit, well, public servant-y. And they immediately started getting nervous. What about liability? What if someone hurts themselves? How do we transport people? And they started fighting and fighting and fighting about all of this stuff. And they really couldn't come down to a conclusion of what we were going to do about all these volunteers that we knew were going to come. And I left the emergency operations center in the wee hours of the morning on Sunday night, Monday morning, to try and get a little bit of sleep. And when I woke up the next morning, my radio went off and I heard an announcement. If you'd like to volunteer, the City of Calgary is inviting you to meet at McMahon Stadium in 2 hours' time. And you can imagine, I sat up in bed and said, how'd that happen? And so I phoned and asked, what did you guys do here? And they said, well, Your Worship, after you left last night, we figured we had to do something, we had to get started, so we just decided we would have people meet at McMahon Stadium. And I said, well, that's great, but were you planning on telling anyone? You've only given them 2 hours' notice on a Monday morning. Who's going to show up? And they said, well, Your Worship, that's actually on purpose, because we don't know what we're doing. And we figure that if a couple hundred people show up today, we'll figure out what we're doing and we'll be ready for a bigger crowd tomorrow. And I rolled my eyes as I do and I said, you know, you guys are dreaming. 200 people are not going to show up. 40 or 50 people are going to show up. But I guess I better go over there and say thank you to the folks. So I got dressed and made my way to McMahon Stadium, and of course this is what I saw. Thousands and thousands of people in coveralls and steel-toed boots, in flip-flops and tank tops, all united by their desire to help strangers, people they didn't even know. There was no PA system. When I got there, one of my colleagues was standing on a folding table attempting to address the crowd. And then I had a brainstorm. I realized that the fire chief had loaned me a vehicle the day before so that I could get into the evacuated zones. And that vehicle had lights and sirens. By the way, he never asked for it back, which tells you a lot about asset management in the Calgary Fire Department. By the way, every time I tell that joke, the fire chief says, actually, it tells you more about the fact that nobody can walk up to the mayor and say, I want my car back. Anyway, I realized that because it had lights and sirens, it must have that thing you never want if you're driving late at night, which is the voice of God behind you. Pull over now. So I climbed up on that table, I leaned into the driver's side of the truck, I pulled out the little PA, and I started talking to people. And my colleague who had been up on the table before me said, Mayor, Mayor, send them home. We've run out of forms. Oh, you think I'm kidding? Look at the guy in the gray shirt right at the front. He's got one of the last forms. And so I took a deep breath. I stood up there. I looked out at this crowd. Visions of municipal lawyers who are a very special breed danced in front of my eyes. And I said, okay, folks, we've run out of forms. There's no more room on the buses. But you're here to help. And you want to help. So go help. Just go. You know what neighborhoods have been badly hit. Just go. And when you get there, it'll be very clear what you can do. You may have to go door to door. I bet you won't. Just go. Just go. And they did. They went. And what followed was the most remarkable outpouring of the power and the resilience of humanity that I have ever seen. If I were still an academic, and I keep reminding the people at Mount Royal University, I'm only on leave. I'm supposed to come back. But if I were still an academic, this would probably be the next 10 years of my research. How do people organize themselves in the lack of formal organization to do extraordinary things? How do everyday people doing everyday things with their everyday hands make extraordinary change in the world. We saw scenes like this throughout the city. Volunteers doing backbreaking, heavy-duty labor for people they didn't even know. This is my favorite photo. I love this photo for so many reasons. First of all, it shows you that the water that was in those basements was not crystal clean glacier water by the time it got to the basements. These people are dirty, they're sweaty, they stink. They actually have no idea whose house it is they're standing in front of. They just know it's someone who needed help and they've been in there for a couple days. Excuse me. They've learned more about ripping out drywall than I will ever know. And they're still smiling. The reason, though, that I love this photo the most is I'd like you to look at their hands. They're so filthy, but their hands are clean. And they're eating hamburgers. And it's the hamburgers that makes me love this photo. Because it reminds me that everyone in our community figured out how they could help. Whether they were doing the backbreaking labor or delivering food to the volunteers. Whether they were kids who put lemonade stands on what felt like every corner in the city, oh my God, I drank a lot of lemonade that week. Raising money for flood relief. Every single person figured out what they could do. This picture always reminds me of a woman that I call Sam's mother. Now, Sam's mom is a fully realized human being. Her name is Lori. She's a professional woman. I used to think she was a lawyer, but she was actually at a speech I gave recently and jumped up and said, "Teacher, teacher, I'm a fully realized human being. I'm not a lawyer." And I remember meeting her that night when she was thinking of herself as Sam's mom. I got into a habit. If I could escape from the emergency operations center for an hour or so at night, I would just go quietly walk in the flood-impacted neighborhoods. No hoopla, no drama, no media. I would just walk and talk to people about their experience and what had happened. I think leaders need to be able to understand human stories. And so one night I was walking and I met Sam's mom and she said to me, "You know, Mayor, I've lost everything in my house. We had 4 feet of water on the main floor. We stripped everything down to the studs. I don't have a stove. I don't have a fridge. I don't have cabinets. I don't have any way to prepare meals for my family. But you know what, Mayor? Tonight for dinner, we had hot shepherd's pie. And when I'm having a rough day, which happens once in a while in this job, I think about that shepherd's pie. I think about the hands that made it, that boiled and peeled and mashed the potatoes, that put the mixture into a casserole dish and quickly covered it with aluminum foil, and the mind that thought for a second, I am never going to see my casserole dish again. But that's okay, because this has to go out the door right now. Because somewhere out there, there's a family that hasn't had a hot meal in days, and I want them to get this shepherd's pie while it's hot. And I think about the hands that did that, and I realize where true power in our community comes from. I spent a lot of time, both as an academic as a politician, talking about civic engagement, about getting people more involved in their communities. I've launched a program that I encourage you all to check out and to steal called Three Things for Calgary, which is just a simple program to encourage every, that's why I wear this number 3 on my lapel, which just encourages every Calgarian every year to do 3 things for their community, whether they're little things like shoveling your neighbor's walk or big things like starting a new nonprofit. Every one of us, everyday people doing everyday things with their everyday hands, has the power to make change in our community. About a week later, I went back to Bowness. Bowness is the community you saw in the very first photo. That Venetian canal was a river called, is a street called Bow Crescent. And I went walking on Bow Crescent, and in the third house on Bow Crescent, just up from the Hextall Bridge in the new park, I ran into a family that I chatted with. They were back in their house. They were very happy to be back in their house. But I poked my head inside, and there was nothing there. It had been stripped down to the studs. I think they were sleeping on hammocks. that couple had found a piece of plywood in their basement. They had scrawled a message on that piece of plywood, and they had nailed it to the tree out front. And of everything I saw that week, all the things I never thought I would see in my life, the rivers running higher and faster and angrier than I had ever experienced, the devastation, the loss, the damage, the hamburgers, of all the things I saw that week, this sign is the one thing that I will never forget. Because to me, it encapsulates what happened during that crisis, but it also encapsulates why Canada works and what I hope you'll get a chance to talk about this afternoon. We lost some stuff. We gained a community. So as today you continue your discussions thinking about the last 20 years and you think about what makes this country work, and we listen to lots of academics and people on every side of the political spectrum debating and discussing everything from universal health care to equalization payments to the bilingual nature of our country and all those things that we talked about when I studied this stuff and we continue to talk about, I'd like you to remember that. That what makes Canada work is something very, very simple. And that is that sense of community. That's what I get to dedicate myself to every day. I'm so lucky that I have been given 7 years to fulfill a simple promise in our community. And that simple promise is that every single person in every single corner of this community, regardless of what they look like or where they came from, regardless of whom they worship or how they love, that every single person in this community has the opportunity right here, right now, to live a great Canadian life. That's the promise of this nation. That's what we work on every single day, and I hope that's what every one of you will recommit yourselves to working on. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mayor Nenshi. Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Okay. We have a couple of questions from people who've tweeted them in. One is from someone named Liz Four. She said, what do you do differently as mayor now, having dealt with the 2013 floods?
Well, we learned, as I said, a fair number of things during the flooding. And really, the biggest thing that I learned was around how people can come to the table when we set the table for them, when we set expectations, like with Three Things for Calgary. So rather than answer the question of what do I do differently, because I think I'm still the same guy, I'll answer a slightly different question, is what can we do even better? And so the question I have for myself is, when you look at that photo of those people at McMahon Stadium and you see that power of humanity that comes together during a crisis, how do we harness that same power to work on homelessness and poverty and environment and all of the other issues that we face every single day? So having started with that political philosophy that people are not stupid, how do we now harness that and use this incredible resource we have at our disposal? 30 million Canadians, 1.2 million of them live in my city. How do we use that talent to make our community better for everyone?
Thank you. Another question. I mean, what is there anything that you think we should change in the way cities are governed, the powers they have, the ways in which they're structured as a result of this experience? You don't have to.
I was told that we had a hard stop, and I wasn't able to go on and on and on and on. That is a whole other issue. But yes, obviously, in 1867, when we had the British North America Act, it was an act for a largely agrarian society. And now, of course, we are, despite our myths about canoes and polar bears and pine trees, we are one of the most urban nations in the world. And as a result, cities have to do incredibly difficult work every single day that we simply don't have the resources or the power to manage. I was only half joking when I said I don't know what it is the federal government does. The vast majority of what the federal government does is write checks. If we actually counted the number of people in Ottawa who just wrote checks, you'd end up with the vast majority of the public service. So we've had a mismatch between our resources and the services that we have to provide. I often joke and say, look, if the federal government disappeared while we were in this room together, it'd probably be a week or two before anyone noticed. You'd stop getting your mail, probably. If your provincial government disappeared, you'd notice pretty quick because you're at a university, but it might be an hour or two before you had a real impact. If your municipal government disappeared, even in Montreal, if your municipal governments, actually you should say municipal governments because you have, I don't know, 107 of them on the island or something. If your municipal governments disappeared, well, you'd have no police, you'd have no fire, you'd have no roads, you'd have no transit, you'd have no clean water, you'd have no parks, you'd have no rinks, you'd have no recreation facilities. And you'd notice pretty quickly because you'd be dead. Yet, the municipal order of government gets 7 or 8 cents of every tax dollar that's spent. And I have to spend most of my life walking around with my hat out saying, please, sir, can I have some more? And we got to fix it. And I'm not talking about constitutional change, but I'm talking about realigning the ability to have revenue with the order of government that actually delivers the service. It's good sense, it makes sense, but it requires our provincial and federal governments to understand that in some ways their spending power is the only power they have.
Okay. We'll let you go now. Thank you so much. This is the perfect place to plug the 2015 MISC conference, which will be in February on the theme of cities. So maybe we can entice you out for that.
I'd love it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Have a wonderful conference and happy birthday once again to MISC.
And I'll now call on Ken White to animate, as we say here, the next panel.
Thank you, Will. Good afternoon, everyone. Bonjour. I'm Ken White, and I am a member of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada Board of Trustees. I am also a recovering journalist, or as the mayor says, now a fully realized human being, employed as Senior Vice President of Public Policy at Rogers Communications. I have been on the McGill board, the Institute board, for 12 of its 20 years now, and one of the things we've always been very conscious of is representing the whole of Canada, so it was really a treat for me to see a fellow Albertan, Mayor Nenshi, giving the keynote speech here this afternoon. I thought he did a wonderful job. He really is a remarkable storyteller, especially for an academic, and I think you got a really good sense of why people think he's one of the more intriguing new political personalities in Canada. We are here today with a panel that I'd like to invite up on stage to join us to discuss a topic very germane to what Mayor Menchie was speaking about on individuals, communities, and global civil society. We have four people here representing the worlds of business, journalism, arts, and community leadership, and I'll introduce them in alphabetical order, after which I will ask them each to speak to you individually for 5 minutes before we open the conversation. And towards the end of the conversation, I will take some questions from the audience via Twitter. We are at hashtag Canada Remix, so I encourage you all to get your questions in. Joining me on stage are Bertrand Sesvet, chairperson and senior partner at Sid Lee, an international creative services agency headquartered in Montreal. John Ibbotson, Globe and Mail journalist, my former colleague, former chief political correspondent, and the author most recently of The Big Shift. We have Professor Ken Lum, artist and University of Pennsylvania professor, a native of British Columbia, and last but not least, chairperson of the National Committee on Inuit Education and former president of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, Mary Simon. Please welcome our panel. Mr. Sivet, let's begin with you. Your thoughts on the theme of individuals, community, and global civil society.
Well, thank you very much. Listen, I'm really happy to be here. I realized I came to school here. That was a long time ago. That was like 30 years ago. And I realized I'd never been in this room. It's a beautiful room. Somehow, I don't know why. But when I finished my studies in economics, my final paper was I asked my colleagues in class, and you know, it was the Cold War back then. I asked them, you know, what's the future of mankind? And you know, the answer was always, well, you know, there's going to be a nuclear holocaust. You know, we're all going to die. You know, and the end of the world is coming. And then I would ask them a couple of, you know, stupid questions, and then I would ask them another question, which is, you know, in a few weeks you're going to graduate, and what are you going to do? And the answer was, well, I'm going to look for a job, I'm going to get married, and I'm going to have kids. So there was always this amazing disconnect between, you know, in, you know, the individuals and their relationship to the environment and the collectivity they live in. So after that, basically, you know, I did the only sensible thing I could think about. I went to advertising. and I've decided, basically, that I would solve the world's problem one ad at a time. However, you know, when I continued my career in advertising, although it looks completely disconnected to my opening statement, what I've been doing for the past, you know, 20 years is probing the human soul, probing, you know, Canadians and probing people all over the world to understand their motivation and their relationship between individualism and their sense of belonging to civil society and to communities at large. And, you know, what I've come to realize is that there is an overwhelming sense today that people have changed a lot, and that, you know, 30 years ago were the good days. Today's basically youth, you know, especially, are not really involved in civil society. They're very apathetic, and you know, their sense and their relationship to government is not as strong as it used to be. And what I'm observing nowadays is that simply, I think that people are, you know, there are two phenomena. The first thing is, I think that Canada as a country, in spite of everything we say, has done fairly well. As we saw in the first presentation, I think that typically people react, and this sense of getting involved with community is typically heightened in the face of crisis, such as a flood or something like that. But when the country is going relatively well, because I'm privileged enough to spend half of my time everywhere around the world, and believe me, I think that Canada has done extremely well, and I think is doing very, very well for the future. What we are lacking right now is leadership. And what we're lacking are big ideas. You know, what we're lacking is something else than response to impending crises, natural crises, the environment. I mean, you know, these are things that get people involved. But what we lack is basically leadership of idea across Canada. However, the good news is what I observe every day as I try to engage with young people around the world is that more than ever, people have a sense that they can solve individually all problems around the world. Last week I was at a conference in Geneva, and I met a young man who was from India, and he told me, well, you know, we were talking about pollution and the environment, and quite simply his answer to that was, you know, I'm going to raise $2 billion and I'm going to create a lunar mining company, and I'm going to find, you know, an incredible rock that's going to solve the world's energy, and then we can move on. So I think that, you know, what I like to focus on now is this great sense of optimism and also the importance of looking for big ideas in our society.
Thank you, Bertrand.
Society, which is everything, right? So I'm not going to talk about all of that. I'm just going to talk about The Big Shift, which some of you may have heard of. It's a book that Daryl Bricker and I wrote. And if the theme of today's talk is remixing Canada, what Daryl and I have argued is that Canada is already well down the path of being remixed. We argue in the book that there are two shifts underway in Canada, both very well advanced, and that they are changing the geopolitical reality of the country. We argue that for most of this country's history, we were governed by what we called the Laurentian elites. This would be you, by the way. We argued that from the Confederation until quite recently, the political, business, public service, academic, cultural, media elites in the cities along the St. Lawrence watershed, principally Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal, but we said the watershed so we could get Kingston in, debated among themselves the big issues of the day, whether it was the national policy or conscription, fighting the Depression, conscription, the infrastructure revolution, the social revolution, the question of Quebec aspirations, fighting the deficit, gay marriage, on all the big issues. The Laurentian elites debated the issues among themselves, usually reached a consensus, and implemented that consensus. Quite often through the Liberal Party, because it was the party federally that was most often in government, but provincial, but conservative parties could do in a pinch. There was no Prime Minister more Laurentian than Brian Mulroney. They governed the country very well. This is an important point, because some people think that the book is an attack on the Laurentian elites. It's not. As we say repeatedly in the book, if you think Canada is a success as a country, and we think Canada is a fabulous country, then we have the Laurentian elites to thank for it, because they ran it. But their influence is in decline, and we think, especially after the last federal election, that decline is now glaringly apparent because of the two big shifts. What are the two big shifts? Well, the first is a shift in power and influence and population to the West. The Laurentian elites never got the West. They never understood the West. They never particularly liked the West. It was far away. It was home to sort of strange populist political uprisings that were, you know, fortunately ephemeral, but it could be largely ignored. Well, it can't be ignored anymore. As you well know, population is shifting to the West. Last year, almost all the job creation that took place in this country took place in Alberta. The last census showed us that there are now more people living in the four western provinces than in Quebec and Atlantic Canada combined. And that shift is continuing, and it will accelerate over time. And now we have, guess what, the first truly Western government in this country's history, from the Western Prime Minister, dominated by Western values and a Western ethos. We think that is reflective of that political shift. And the second shift is the result of the greatest achievement of the Laurentian consensus, which was multiculturalism and immigration. Lester Pearson dropped the color bar and created the point system in the 1960s, and Brian Mulroney increased the quotas, and John Cretchen maintained them in the 1980s and 90s, so that now we bring in more people than any other country on the planet Earth, from more places than any other country on the planet Earth takes people, and we do it year after year after year. We have brought in two Torontos in the last 20 years. We have duplicated this country's largest city twice. And if you do that, you're going to change the politics. And if you fill those two new cities with people from parts of the world who traditionally had not ever been in this country, then the transformation is going to be profound. And that's the second shift. We have found, and this is where Daryl Bricker's contribution is particularly helpful through his polling analysis at Ipsos Reid, we have found that aspirational, middle-class, suburban immigrants, the millions and millions and millions of people living outside the city of Toronto, living outside Ottawa, living outside Montreal and Calgary, Edmonton, Vancouver, Lower Mainland, but especially the ones living outside the 905, because there are so many of them. They are more economically and they are more socially conservative than most of the native-born. So there is a new coalition emerging, a coalition of aspirational, middle-class, especially aspirational, middle-class immigrant voters in the big cities outside Toronto and other parts of Western Central and Western Canada, and the West. That new coalition is stable, it is permanent, and it will grow over time. It does not mean that the Conservatives are going to win every election. It doesn't. Any election is a crapshoot. But it means that there is an inherent advantage to this new Conservative coalition, and it's one that politically we're going to have to get used to if we're going to understand what's happening in our federal political life. I have 25 minutes more to go, but I think you're going to cut me off.
Thank you, John.
Well,
With respect to Mayor Nenshi's speech, which I thought was it's a great speech, I do want to express some contention, which I don't really entirely agree with the mayor. One large component, which is the definition of a Canadian being basically a metric of how much presence the government has in your life. I don't really agree with that. Right? I think that's... I believe in government. I live in the United States, where the disbelief in government is you know, dysfunctional. But I also don't believe in that the definition of Canadians is defined by government presence. Right? Of course, that shapes the society and so all that. Because what's missing is something that Bertrand was just relating to, which is, you know, being a Canadian is about something to do with vision in terms of our place in the world. I would say that that question was certainly very foremost in Canadians' minds, leaders among the population, decades ago. Let's say, you know, after the Bandung Conference, during the Trudeau period, and so on. And it's become less so now. Canada is much more aligned, and our wealth is actually a function of the fact that we're part of, you know, we're in a big club. We're in the club of, you know, like, what, top dozen richest countries. So we have a lot of fortuitousness in terms of why we're wealthy, too. So we have to keep that in mind. I'm grateful for that. I'm not saying I'm not. I'm grateful for that, right? But we also have to keep in mind that, you know, someone growing up in Calcutta can't get into here because he's poor, right? They have a hassle even trying to immigrate nowadays. It's true that we have multiculturalism in terms of immigration, but increasingly, it's like it's not for my grandfather who came over as a coolie. It's for someone who, you know, can buy $1 million in Vancouver and not even live in the house, right? And just kind of wait for it to sell while they make, you know, while they run their businesses in Hong Kong or Shanghai. So I think there's a lot of problems in terms of Canada, and it relates to a kind of precisely the ontological question of who we are. And we don't seem to ask that question so much. I want to make another point, which is that I live in the United States and in Philadelphia, and I meet a lot of very successful Canadians. I'm talking academics everywhere. Even in my city now of Philadelphia, the conductor of the symphony is from Montreal, Yannick Séguin. The director of the Penn Museum is from Toronto or Kingston. The director of the Children's Museum is from Ottawa. That's just three, you know, big positions in the city, and there's many, many more. So that tells me that there's enormous fluidity in terms of what Canada is doing right, in terms of the success stories of Canadians, right? The odd thing is that even though I'm running into, in fact, last week I had dinner with two professors, both from Yale. One was a Russian expert, Russian cinema expert, and came from Fort McMurray. So it's very, you know, very successful. He learned Russian in his 20s, and now he's like the head of cinema studies at Yale University. And the other was a Chinese woman who spoke with a Chinese accent, but she was a professor of French at Yale, who also learned French during her graduate days and so on. So there's lots of stories like this. So the issue isn't whether, you know, we're just a small country and we don't have a lot of success in terms of, you know, and that's why we need to batten down hatches and, you know, and kind of reprise constantly every day the garrison mentality. There's, you know, success stories are easy to find out there, right? So, but yet at the same time, I feel that there's also this kind of odd divide between Canadians who don't kind of recognize that. Right? And this, I'm not trying to make the argument that somehow, you know, you have to go abroad to find success, and so that's really a boring argument. I'm just saying that there are success stories out there, and we have to kind of recognize that. So, right? I wanted to also make one more point about Canadians as well, which is one more point related to that, which is that I live in the United States, as I say. There are a lot of problems in terms of the city that's on my home, Philadelphia. And being a Canadian has actually afforded me a real amazing vantage point, which I think is a real privilege and a function of my education, my formation in Canada, which has allowed me to kind of look at my new home as an outsider. And I think that's a real privileged position, to be a kind of outsider, right? But I also feel every time I come back north of the border, I feel like I'm coming home, but I also feel that I'm also an outsider here too, right? And I think that's actually good. I and bad. I feel like an outsider increasingly in my hometown, my original hometown of Vancouver. I don't really kind of recognize anymore. It's become Monte Carlo. It's become kind of this other place that doesn't. It's a lot of good restaurants, so it's not like I bemoan all the changes to it. But I think there's something that we've become detached in terms of what Bertrand was asking, which is, you know, what does it mean in terms of philosophically, not monetarily, but philosophically, to be a Canadian today and for the future.
Thank you very much. Last but not least, Mary.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. Nakomik takunga hai khoyao si magama. Montreal mot hai khoyigat si khoyan namirpunga. I just wanted to say a few words in my language, which is Inuktitut. I'm from Kujuak in Nunavik, in the northern part of the province of Quebec, on the Angava coast. So it's a real pleasure for me to share the stage in this conversation with the three gentlemen, Bertrand, John, and Ken, and also to listening to the inspiring words of the mayor from Calgary, Mayor Nenshi. When he showed that sign that said, "We lost some stuff, we gained a community," what I got out of that was that story he told was really talking about people. You know, oftentimes when we talk about governments and organizations, we don't really talk about the fact that it's people that are in those organizations and in those governments. And the fact that he recognized that and the enormous amount of effort people make to make things work. We tend to pick on things that don't work, but we also need to remember that there's a lot of things that do work. Today, I mean, the issue of Aboriginal peoples in Canada hasn't been raised yet, but being an Aboriginal person from the Inuit community, I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about it, and because I think it's part of the conversation that we need to have in Canada. I've worked in government. I've worked in communities. I've worked in non-governmental organizations. So I have a sense of the importance of enlisting individuals, communities, and the global civil society in bringing about change. I think we need all those aspects. And the debate and the struggle and the negotiations that Inuit have engaged in over the last 30 years, which I've been involved in, which have culminated in the settlement of our land claims agreements, has been about carving out a relationship with the center of political and economic authority and power, and about regaining pride in ourselves. And I think I can probably say that for other Aboriginal peoples in Canada as well. So in thinking about the process of bringing about change, I think it necessitates a couple of key ingredients. First, I think you must find a way of organizing like-minded people that will work together. So when I think of about the infinite possibilities, for instance, that internet and the social media have provided for organizing like-minded communities and of people, I get excited about it because these useful tools were never available to my generation of leaders, and as well as, you know, having been a bit of an activist myself in the early days, we didn't have those available. So throughout the Arctic, I have seen a lot of innovative and creative social media campaigns develop to connect and inform activists, and it is inspiring. For instance, take food security as an example. There was a big issue about food security for a few years ago in the north, not just in Nunavut, but it's there across the Arctic. And we really worked through the social media on this because nobody had funds and resources to travel all over Canada to talk about it, so we used the social media. So these are things that I think are really important. The second key ingredient, I think, in bringing about change is harder to achieve, and that is to create the political space to bring about change. If I look back over the past 40 years, I can say that the emergence of international human rights legislation and the work of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples and the declaration by the UN, such as the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, have really helped create a political space for Inuit and other Aboriginal peoples that say, okay, we have rights, or you have rights, and we have issues related to our well-being that need to be honored and addressed. I think that conversation needs to continue in Canada as well as with the other conversations that have been highlighted today. And this brings me to what I have now spent the last 6 years focused on almost entirely, and that is education. The need to close gaps in our education systems so more of our youth graduate, and the right to preserve, protect, and promote our languages in our education systems. We researched this for 2 years and came out with a national strategy, which I've been working on, as you see through my title. And I'm really encouraged to discover that there is a growing number of Canadians who also feel that. As a nation, we must, I think, commit to improving outcomes in Aboriginal education. We really feel very strongly about that. And then I'll talk about the, I know I'm probably running out of time here. I just want to speak about this last initiative I'm involved in, which is I was invited by the former Northwest Territories Premier Cackwi, to join with Prime Minister Paul Martin, Joe Clark, and other distinguished Canadians, which some are here, in a common cause to strengthen Canada through the creation of a new partnership between Indigenous peoples and other Canadians. And it's called Canadians for a New Partnership, and it was unveiled earlier this month at the Museum of History in Ottawa. And as I said earlier, change comes from like-minded people organizing and working to create a political space to move forward. So I really encourage you to visit the website for Canadians for a New Partnership and read our declaration, because it is a declaration about change and the future of Canada, and that is the focus of our conversation today. So thank you very much.
One of the interesting things that the mayor said was that the government of Canada could disappear and it'd take 2 weeks for the rest of us to know about it. I'd like to know what you all think about, well, is he correct? And what role does a national government now play in people's sense of society and social engagement?
Well, for me, one of the things I have to say that, you know, in my experience, and again, you know, I spent a lot of my time trying to, attract very smart people to work with me. And I would agree with the mayor that the city has become a very, very important unit. People relate a lot more in my conversations and trying to convince people to join my project. The question of, you know, will I live in Paris, Toronto, Amsterdam, or New York City? has become bigger than which country we live in. However, I think that at the same time, I think that the role of the federal government is to drive leadership, is to drive a vision, is to drive a sense of identity, that an aspiration that, of course, can be driven at the city level. But I think that the city, as powerful as it is in transforming and driving the future, has limitations in what it can contribute to the world stage.
John?
Oh, I disagree. So why not? Let's have some fun. You might have noticed the absence of the federal government after only a week when Pierre Trudeau was prime minister, because he was part of a multi-generational effort to get the federal government to mean something to someone somewhere. And we spent an awful lot of time in rooms like this asking ontological questions about what is it that we are as a country? What do we mean? What is our vision? How can we define ourselves other than not as bad as the Americans? And there were a great many conferences like this, and we sat in a great many rooms like this and had a great many discussions like this. Meanwhile, the country just got on with itself. And I think one of the things that has happened has been a blessed withdrawal of the federal government from the faces of its citizens. We saw that starting after the 1995 referendum, when Chrétien devolved significant amount levels of powers to the provincial governments in response to that. And we've seen it accelerated under Stephen Harper, who you will remember wrote the firewall letter saying, what can we do to get the federal government out of our lives, especially out of areas of jurisdiction to which it should not be intruding? And Stephen Harper, the author of the firewall letter, ended up becoming Stephen Harper, the prime minister, and he answered his own letter. He said, we'll just get you out of people's lives. So under him, we've had a decade now in which the federal government does not interfere in areas of provincial jurisdiction. It does not initiate new spending programs. It handles the things that the federal government handles, which you can go several weeks without noticing. That includes the post office, by the way. And it has resulted, I think, in, for me, at least from where I sit, a period of calm, the like of which we have never seen since the 1950s. And that, while at the same time, the country itself, on its own, without the guidance of elites, is inventing itself and reinventing itself and defining itself and making Vancouver one of the most fabulous cities on earth, making Toronto one of the most fabulous cities on earth, and Montreal as well. So I don't really think we need any of this vision thing. I think everything is just fine. And if it's 3 weeks before you notice the federal government, that would be an improvement.
Okay. Ken, do you want to take it?
I don't think there's a yes or no answer to that. It's both, actually. I think what John's talking about in terms of a kind of diminution in terms of the presence of the government, and certainly in redundant and unnecessary spheres of individual lives, is a good thing. And Canadians, I think, still harbor a kind of unhealthy degree of apprehension in terms of that transformation, right? And I think that that's not necessarily a good trait of Canadians not to be more skeptical than they are in terms of government, to be honest. And I believe in a good functioning government. So, you know, I often will say that as an artist, and people, other Canadian artists will say, "How could you say that? You're just some reactionary." And so, anybody who knows me knows that that's not true. I just think that as an artist, it's incumbent upon us to be skeptical of the government. You know, because that's traditionally been the role of modern artists and so on. Now, I do think that being said, what John says is good. But I also think it's bad in the sense that it's the role of government to kind of see the big picture, right? Offer a kind of vision in terms of where should we be going in terms of spheres of technological investment, infrastructure, those types of things. We're not addressing those. Certainly, it was, I have to say, addressed at one time when we came up with the annex satellites and the idea of Canada would lead in terms of a kind of you know, in advance of even the invention of the internet, in fact. There's a whole kind of theory in terms of, you know, academics. There's an alignment between academics on campus, such as McLuhan and Stephen Fry and others, and the industries. And smart governments in around the world, from Norway to South Korea, for example, they know how to mobilize and say, okay, this is what we need to do in order to make sure that our kids are educated in the right areas to prepare themselves for the future. So in that sense, I think government is actually not playing sufficiently its proper role.
Mary, anything to add?
Well, I think, John, we could have quite a discussion here.
Same here.
Because, I, you know, coming from an Aboriginal background and from the Aboriginal community, it's not about getting the feds out of our lives. It's about getting them engaged so that we can make changes to what the status quo is. And it's about, like, coming from the Arctic where there's no services in terms of a lot of things we take for granted in Montreal or in southern parts of Canada. We need the engagement of governments. I mean, whether it be territorial, federal, provincial, depends on who you are. I mean, the First Nations want to deal directly with the federal government. Inuit are more open in terms of the relationship building we have with the province and the federal government because of the land claims agreements that we've signed, the modern day agreements, which are considered treaties as well. But, you know, there are limitations. So you're talking about many different facets of what governments need to do. And they need to, I agree with Ken, they need to mobilize on certain things. If they don't mobilize, then, it's not going to help any one of us. So it's not one or the other. You know, there has to be some. I think a country like Canada needs debates on some very important issues that we're facing. And that's why I'm so excited about this new organization that's called Canadians for a New Partnership, because it's about Canadians and the Aboriginal peoples of Canada and non-Aboriginal peoples. Let's have a discussion and a debate about how we address some of the dark history and leave it behind us. Let's move forward. How do we move forward? You know, everybody talks about the fact that we're at a pivotal point in our history or in our future regarding Aboriginal peoples in Canada. So what is that pivotal point? You know, we need to have that conversation. So I think government has a role, but not, it's also a nonpartisan organization like Canadians for a New Partnership that has a role. So right. It means us, me and you.
Okay. Our theme is individuals, communities, and global civil society. Now, we have seen tremendous advances in the last couple of decades in technology. It's given individuals untold new opportunities to express themselves, to develop personally. It's given rise to new communities, new community formations at a scale that was inconceivable before. How are these technological developments affecting our notion of civil society, and where is it headed?
Well, one of the things, though, I'd like to go back to what you said before, because
go ahead.
I mean, I woke up this morning and Stephen Harper was not at the UN, you know, to discuss climate change this morning. I think that's a shame. I think that, yes, it's all very nice as individualistic Canadians. We all think that we can play God and everything will take care of itself. But I think our federal government has a role to play on the world stage to tackle, you know, a very, very significant issue that it cannot be left alone. I think that, so I'll just clarify this before I tackle your question. I think that, you know, the social media, in my opinion, is changing everything, because it creates a torrent of information. The job that you do, the job that great institutions like the Globe and Mail and La Presse and our national papers and leadership from the St. Lawrence elite, as you called it, used to play, that role has disappeared, and everything has been basically shattered into pieces, and now everybody has become an expert on everything. And everybody, gets around and gets excited about throwing ice buckets on people's head and everything. And personally, I don't, although this is a commendable and there's a positive impact and there are good things that come out of this, I think that this country still needs, as I said, a strong leadership to tell us, who do we want to be as a collective group of people?
Yeah. Well, I guess the interesting thing within my own argument is that we used to have in the media a number of gatekeepers who played an enormous amount of influence in deciding issues. I remember when I was, before I was even a journalist, during the free trade debates, I would get up, I would get the Globe and Mail, I would read the front page, I would turn to Jeffrey Simpson, because Jeffrey Simpson was leading the debate on free trade. That's all gone now. Jeffrey's not. Jeffrey's in the office next to mine.
He hasn't left the building yet.
But we do have this democratization of ideas. The gatekeepers hold much less influence than they ever had before. Netflix, the institutions themselves are dissolving. This fight, you must have seen this in the paper today. The CRTC hauls Netflix up and says, give us all your information. And Netflix says, go away. And now the CRTC has to decide what it's going to do with Netflix. Is it going to try to rope it under the Broadcasting Act and impose Canadian content on it? But surely we all see what's under threat is not Netflix. What's under threat is the CRTC. That institution's days are numbered, no matter who the next government is, because there is this broadening out of accesses of information, of access to information, and of instant experts. We don't need elites to tell us who we are. There is a free play of market forces and ideas, and as everything, as well as everything else. And it's not just about buckets of ice over the head. It's about new voices coming up with new ideas that win us over and that excite us. And they are the ones who are going to define us in the future.
Well, suddenly it just made me think about the internet was invented 2 years after the death of Marshall McLuhan, who was quite prescient in terms of the theories of the internet, right? I think with social media the way it is today, it's there's a lot of information that's dispensed to everybody in synchrony, can be an incredibly unifying force. Think about man walking on the moon, right? That was before the internet. Right, and yet, that was just with newspapers. And then to think about the difference between that and then 9/11. So good and bad, it's incredibly unifying in terms of that. And so that tells us something about, what you have to deal with in terms of the question of national identity. Right, there's nothing in terms of national identity is ever going to match this new sense of global citizenship. That's far in excess of anything that you can say is what defines a Canadian, right? But having said that, I do think that being a Canadian is still something worth pursuing. My only problem is I don't sense that big question of what are the things that are worth pursuing is actually being asked. That's kind of absent nowadays. So I do think that. We really don't think we should be obsessing in terms of, that there's one essence or there's even a composite of essences that make up Canadians, because I don't think there are any. But I do think, sort of like what Northrop Frye believed, which was that, Canadians are, they have stories to tell in terms of their formation being shaped by their sensory environment, right? And their sense of local history. Right, and I think Canadians, by and large, don't work hard enough
be honest, to kind of read history or even read the history against the grain to find out about, about what's going on in the world. And I think that's an area where I think government could play a better role.
Mayor?
Well, we tend to hear a lot of negative things about Aboriginal peoples and what's happening in our communities, but there's some good stories too, and I think not enough focus is given to those stories because the media tends to not pick up on those. But I just want to tell you a little quick story that is a very positive story because it has to do with social media. In the Arctic, in four regions of the Arctic, there are four Inuit regions, and we have different writing systems that were all introduced by missionaries that went into the Arctic. We have the syllabic system that's written differently depending on where you are. We have the orthography, the Roman orthography, written differently depending on where you are. So you're talking about probably five different kind of distinct writing systems for 55,000 people. So over the last 5 years since I've been working on in education, we've been using a lot of social media to talk back and forth, especially with the young people. And the young people have great minds. I mean, they're just so, they explore things. And one of the things that we decided through this education work that I was doing is that we have to unify our writing system as a people in order to have the kind of education system that we want, and to be able to educate our kids at a standard that is comparable or equivalent to the Canadian standard, or hopefully it could be better. Who knows? But we can't do that without a unified writing system. We don't want to change the dialects, and people misunderstand that a lot of times, that we're trying to change the dialects of the Inuit language. We're not. We're trying to change the writing system. So through social media, what is emerging, which is really exciting, is that the young people of today that have small kids and families that are sort of not highly educated individuals, but that are educated enough to go on the internet and the media, so Facebook or whatever, social media, are saying, okay, let's make a decision about our writing system. It's going to happen next year. And I have a feeling, I can't say what it's going to be, but I have a feeling, because the people, the Inuit that are talking on social media are actually speaking Inuktitut, but using the Roman orthography as a way of doing it, because not everybody does syllabics. All Inuit speak Inuktitut, but they don't use syllabics in three of the four regions. So people are using Roman orthography as a way of communicating. So that is shifting the whole conversation in a different way. And I wanted to say that about social media being a positive thing for us.
That's a great, great anecdote, yes. We're here in a university, and you said, Bertrand, nobody's thinking big. No big ideas. Ken said nobody's asking the big questions. What's the role of the university today in building civil society? Is it doing a good job as an institution, or universities as institutions, doing all they could to be promoting civil values?
Well, I think, you know, the universities in Canada, we have a great education system. I think that, you know, again, you know, because I have the privilege of recruiting people from all over the world, I can tell you that, in my opinion, our education system, especially higher education, is very solid in Canada. But one of the things that, you know, for me, I think is very important to build a strong civil society is a conversation about the future. And I think that, you know, that's true of business, that's true of governance, and that's true of academic institutions as well. I think that, you know, if we're going to rally about something, if we're going to discover big ideas, if we're going to build a common project for humankind, it's by being deeply, deeply passionate about the future.
And so where do you see big ideas coming from now?
Big ideas are come from basically problem solving, by throwing problems at people that are interesting. But I think that what we have to build in everybody around Canada and everywhere around the world is a belief that there is a solution. It's that fundamental optimism that drives creativity. Without a sense of optimism, there's no creativity. We could all go to bed and we could die and sleep. And I think that's what the universities have to foster amongst our youth, is this sense that they can impact the future and that kid problems can be solved.
John? Yeah, I'm on a leave of absence, as you heard from the Globe this year. I'm down at the Center for International Governance Innovation in Waterloo, which is on the Grand River, which flows into the St. Lawrence, all making it part of the Laurentian Consensus. Now, I'm going to get yelled at this point because I don't know these numbers for sure, but I believe Wilfrid Laurier's enrollment is down 20% this year. So public affairs at Wilfrid Laurier, get on Twitter and correct that number right away. But that's at least I was told. There's the real problem that we're having, that many universities are having right now, is that, again, we're bringing in 250,000 people a year. Every year, we're bringing them in from China and India and the Philippines. Those are the three top intake countries. Parents are aspirational. They have huge ambitions for their children. They want their children to get ahead. And they have not a huge interest in seeing their kids taking a degree that ends in ology. So while computer sciences, while engineering, while the professions are doing well, humanities and social sciences are in trouble. And they're in trouble, I think, especially because, and this is something we have to start thinking about, the social sciences and humanities are in trouble because immigrant Canadians are not interested in them as much as native-born are. And children generally, whether immigrant or native-born, are much more concerned, and rightly so, in a deeply competitive environment with finding jobs that will allow them to lead good lives and look after their children. So the big challenge for universities right now is going to be justify yourself. Again, in a world where ultimately market forces predominate, even in the academy, justify yourself or explain how you are going to face a future of anything other than relentless and remorseless decline.
I agree with John, but I would reframe it differently. I would
say everyone wants to reframe it differently.
Just to make it more correct. I would say that the younger generation, the young people and so on, they've become far less literary than my generation and those older than me. That's good and bad. It means that literary means they're not reading books. They're reading, but they're not reading books, and which requires a certain type of patience and a certain type of passage of time and commitment, and makes you think differently. And so, and yet the universities were born out of this period where it's structured on the environment, the ambience of the literary, and that's why it's in crisis. There's a kind of non-identity problem, to quote Hegel, between this younger generation who are non-literary. I'm not saying they're not smart or anything, I'm just saying they're non-literary. And then you have this physical environment of the university, which is still very defined in terms of literature. And I think that needs to somehow resolve itself somehow.
Mary.
Well, universities have worked hard with us, with, I think, Aboriginal peoples in Canada, McGill being one of them for sure, especially with Nunavik at the beginning when we were trying to get our education system in place where we had our own teachers. So there's other universities across the country that have also been very involved, like the legal course in BC that where we had, for the first time, Inuit lawyers, and also PEI, where people graduated from the BSc social program. So there's been a lot of different things happening with us, working with us, and I think we need to encourage that because we don't yet have a university in the Arctic. I think that's the next big project that is on the minds of the younger generation now, is that even though we do have colleges, the UConn College, the Nunavut College, what used to be Arctic College, and I think they're working towards, being able to grant degrees, but it's still up, pretty much in the works. But as you probably, being from a university, know that when Aboriginal students come to universities, they have a hard time because it's not, they're outside of their comfort zone, basically, out of their own communities, and they're not, used to being with non-Aboriginal students every day. So it's a difficult situation where students end up, going home before they finish or graduate. So the role of university in our civil society is very different from the role of university in sort of the mainstream Canadian civil society. So there's a big distinction there.
We have a question on Twitter about optimism and civil society. And I've sensed on this panel actually quite a bit of optimism, despite challenges to national institutions, civic institutions, Laurentian elites. There seems to be a sense that people, as the mayor said, can be trusted to reform and direct their own communities, and that we're actually making some real progress in the realm of civil society. Would you agree with that, Bertrand?
Well, I think that I'm not sure that civil society is progressing at the speed of internet. Is not progressing at the speed of technology. I think that right now, I think that there are a lot of things that have been disrupted by technology in the last 30 and 40 years. But I think that that we would we can argue that civil society is struggling because there's a lot of structure. There's a lot of hardwired things that need to be transformed in the way we organize ourselves. But I think that this, as the world and as technology has changed so many things, I think we can all anticipate a little bit. It goes back to my initial comment about this sense of optimism that in the end, that the problems, even though they're quite big and they're getting bigger in front of us, can be solved, that science somehow and knowledge in the end will take us out of that. I can't say for sure that it's the majority view of all Canadians, but there's certainly, again, in the world that I'm in the world of creativity, there is a deeply rooted belief that all these change will, in the end, impact civil society as well.
John? Daryl and I say in the Big Shift that we think Canada is the world's most successful country. So I think we're pretty profoundly optimistic. I believe it deeply. I don't think there is a society on earth that has achieved what we have achieved. In a way, it's the result of our failures, as success so often is. Canada never became a nation. Quebec, obviously, the Quebecois are a nation within Canada, but Canada never became a nation. It's a failure as a nation. But it paved the way for us to become a wonderful post-national state. It's the culture of accommodation, as we call it, that makes it possible for us to get along with each other, bearing in mind that there aren't a lot of us. We're spread out along a very long border. We speak different languages, and right from the get-go, the only way we could make the thing work was to give each other distance, give each other space, give each other respect. That turned out to be a fabulous formula for bringing in millions and millions of immigrants from all around the world. It gives them the space to feel that they belong, to feel that they're respected, and to come up with the exciting ideas, the creativity, the outside-the-box thinking that you're seeing in our major cities now. The country is rebalancing. The rise of the West is all for the good. It creates a powerful new region to counterbalance the center. The cities are the most cosmopolitan places on the planet. And when you look at that, when you look at that sort of post-national, multicultural, cosmopolitan, urban society, how can you not feel optimistic about this country? And if that doesn't work, then just read a copy of The Economist and find out how much worse everyone else is doing compared to us.
Well, I think that as a Canadian citizen, there's lots to be optimistic about, but then we were dealt a good hand. We live in a kind of world peak economy in terms of commodities, and we have a lot of commodities that the rest of the world increasingly needs. And so we're very lucky. And so as a Canadian, we're up to, you know, it's kind of like we're on the right ship. It's not the one that's sinking.
It's so easy to be optimistic.
Right? Yeah, it's easy to be optimistic. Right? But as a citizen of the world, I'm not optimistic. I think, you know, hell's going, you know, alive and well all over the world. It's a disaster, right? I spent time residing in, from Dakar, Senegal, spent a lot of time in West Africa, India, you name it, right? Got sick in some of these places. Did I enjoy it? No, not on a certain level, but do I regret it? No, because it made me really see how lucky we are as Canadians. But that brings me to my point, which is that we cannot just be complacent in terms of feeling how optimistic we are as Canadians. We cannot allow ourselves just to define ourselves as Canadians just within our borders. We have to define our Canadian-ness in relationship to our role as global citizens, right? So I don't think it's... I think, you know, excessive optimism can lead to a kind of hubris, which makes us forget about the other and our relationship to the rest of the world. So that's how I would answer it. I would say, by and large, I'm not optimistic, but, you know, if you were to artificially just kind of define Canada as within the borders, the political borders, there is a lot of optimism.
Mary.
Well, I'm generally an optimistic person, and I do my work in that fashion. But I feel a little bit out of place in this discussion because I think if I'm not representing all the Aboriginal peoples in Canada. I come from the Inuit community, and we have certain challenges in the Inuit community. For instance, you know, we've been talking about how rich this country really is, and what a beautiful place. I mean, I love Canada. I think it's one of the greatest countries in the world. But when you live in a region like the Arctic and you talk about climate change, for instance, and our Prime Minister is not talking about climate change, we have some very serious adaptation issues facing us in the Arctic right now in regards to climate change. And I, as a leader in my former position as the president of the National Inuit Organization, every time I talked internationally, I talked about the fact that even though we live in a developed country, a rich country like Canada, we really need adaptation measures in the Arctic, but we can't get those adaptation measures because we live in a developed country in a region that compares to a developing country. So there's all these rules and regulations why we can't have access to mitigation and adaptation measures that other regions get around the world. So, you know, that puts a real damper on an issue like climate change for us because it's affecting our people every day. If you want to see change, go to the Arctic on climate change. So it's hard for me to talk about other indigenous or Aboriginal peoples in Canada because take, for instance, the Education Act that just went down the tubes not too long ago. Who's suffering because of that? The kids, the children that should have benefited from that agreement. I'm not blaming I'm not going to get into a discussion about who was wrong and who was right, but the victims of that whole process are the children that aren't going to get the education. There was a lot of dollars involved. They're not going to get the education that they so deserve. So optimism is something that, you know, that I think varies from region to region and within peoples in Canada. We said we were at a turning point in the country in relation to Aboriginal issues. I think that's what the young people are saying. Not people like me, necessarily, because I've been through the process and I know what our history is like, but young people are looking to the future for change.
Good. That brings us to the end of our time. I'd like to thank our panel for their very intelligent and interesting comments. We're now going to take a short break of 10 minutes. I invite you to all get up and stretch your legs, and we'll be back here, as I say, 10 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.
And so, if you do sit down.
Bonjour et rebonjour, si vous voulez prendre vos places. Bonjour à tous. Je suis Antonia Maioni et il me fait un grand plaisir de participer à cette conférence avec vous cet après-midi. My name is Antonia Maioni and I'd like to begin by thanking Will and Suzanne for inviting us here this afternoon to this wonderful conference to celebrate McGill Institute for the Study of Canada's 20th anniversary. As Ken White said, he's a recovering journalist. I'm a recovering director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, which means that today, for the first time in my life, I'm at an event where I didn't actually have to organize. And I'm very happy about that, and I want to thank the organizers for doing such a wonderful job. I'd also like to reiterate the thanks that we all have here at McGill University, in particular those of us who have worked at the Institute, for the vision that Charles Bronfman had, along with Alex Patterson, in getting the Institute off the ground and putting it into motion, into the other chairs of the Board of Trustees, Denise Chong, Lily de Grandpre, and its current chairs, Michael Goldblum and Ad Danson, for all of their work throughout the years on behalf of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. And also to thank two pairs of four, our four deans, who have been with us through the 20 years of the Institute, Deans McCallum, Miller, Hall, and Manfredi, and our principals at McGill, who have also always been a great source of support for the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. That is to say, Principals Johnston, Shapiro, Monroe Bloom, and Fortier. Merci beaucoup. Thanks to you all. One of the things I've been doing since I left the MISC has been, I guess, trying to justify myself. As John Ibbotson would say, I now hold the position of President of the Humanities and Social Sciences of Canada. It's a federation that works on behalf of scholars and universities in the humanities and social sciences, so I'd be happy to justify myself at any time in the next few minutes or this afternoon or evening. And the other thing I've done is I've made it my business to travel from coast to coast to coast. And I just want to reiterate what Mary Simon said about Canada being such a beautiful country, no matter where you go, but also having a lot of challenges, no matter where you go as well. And I'm hoping that the students who are in this room today, and those of who are with us through Twitter and social media, will also have it as their goal to visit this country from coast to coast to coast. Je veux remercier nos conférenciers distingués qui ont accepté l'invitation de réfléchir avec nous sur un sujet qui est très important aussi au futur du Canada, c'est-à-dire l'expression publique, un sujet qui nous tient tous à cœur. Ils sont tous des gens qui ont dévoué leur vie au futur de ce pays, mais aussi à la question de comment on s'exprime dans une démocratie, comment on s'exprime dans le public. Our speakers this afternoon have accepted an invitation, but also a challenge, to address an important question of the future of how we express ourselves in Canada, in public, as a democracy, a topic that they've all familiar with and concerned with in their lives and professions. We've asked them to reflect on how Canadians are making their voices heard, how can Canadians actually express themselves in a way that can have an impact, how do the mediums of expression, as we discussed in the previous panel, technology, affect how the general public engages with democracy, and how, as Mayor Nenshi really told us that we should be doing, how do engaged citizens push for improvement, give voice to the powerless, and actually try to encourage collective action on new and emerging challenges facing Canada. I will introduce them in alphabetical order, and then I'll ask them to address you individually for just a few moments before opening the conversation. Ils vont parler dans les deux langues, en anglais et en français, et vous êtes aussi encouragés à envoyer vos questions par Twitter dans les deux langues. Alors, sur scène avec moi, nous avons la présidente directrice générale de Montréal International, Dominique Anglade. Bonjour. Dominique Anglade is the CEO and president of Montreal International, an organization whose mandate is to attract foreign direct investment, international organization and strategic talent to Greater Montreal. Nous avons aussi avec nous l'éditorialiste en chef du journal La Presse, Monsieur André Pratt. André Pratt, from La Presse, who is an opinion leader here in Quebec and also the celebrated author in his own right. We are also very fortunate to have accepted our invitation the former Premier of Ontario and interim leader of the Liberal Party of Canada and currently a senior partner at the law firm of Ulthius Clear Townshed LLP, the Honourable Bob Ray. Bonjour, Mr. Ray. And how wonderful also to have with us the host and creator of Spark, CBC Radio's national radio show and podcast about, what else, technology and culture, Nora Young. Hello, Nora. Alors, bienvenue à vous tous. Je vais commencer, Dominique, de mener la balle. Dominique.
Merci beaucoup. Est-ce que vous m'entendez bien? Oui? OK, parfait. So, good afternoon, everybody. It is a pleasure for me to be here with you today. And before starting, we're talking about messages, we're talking about communication, we're talking about the way social media interferes with the way Canadians are expressing themselves. But first and foremost, I would like to take a step back and talk about Canada. The previous panel was talking about whether they were optimistic and pessimistic about the future of Canada. And I want to share, right from the start, how optimistic I am. I think we have a wonderful country, and I think we have such a great message that we need to convey, but that we don't convey enough. Canada has been able to do something that is absolutely unique in the world. We've been able to create a society where we actually have a good social mobility. So if your father is rich, it doesn't mean that you're going to be rich. If your father is poor, it doesn't mean that you're going to be poor. So if you have the capability and if you have the willingness, you can succeed in Canada. I like to say to my American colleagues that the American dream is in fact Canadian. And I really believe that. And if you look at the social mobility that we've created in Canada, it compares itself to social mobility that you find in the Scandinavian countries. But the difference between Canada and the Scandinavian countries is immigration. We've been able to do this with immigration, integrating new people to our country and making it work and making sure that we create that social mobility. Why am I talking about this? Is I think this is a key message that we have to convey a lot more abroad. Je reviens d'un voyage présentement à l'étranger, et chaque fois que l'on parle du Canada et du succès canadien, les gens sont toujours étonnés. On reste encore inconnus dans le reste du monde, et on a un devoir d'accélérer ces communications-là. And the current context of communication has allowed us to really create a momentum to convey this message. So at Montréal International, our responsibility is to attract foreign direct investments into the metropolis. And I'll just give you a few examples of how things have changed recently for us. The way we communicate with our partners, the way we use social media, has allowed us to build a network across Canada of all the equivalent of Montreal International across Canada. So there's Montreal International, there is Quebec International, but there's also one in BC, one in Calgary, and across the country, we're really able to pull together and really leverage what we have. Another example that I can think of is something that we are about to launch. Very often, we have a lot of people that want to talk about Canada, that want to talk about Montreal, they don't necessarily have something to say. Madame Fortier rit, but because sometimes when you think of Montreal in the last few years, what was there to share, really? It was problematic for us internationally. And I think right now, we have a lot of positive elements that we can share, and we're creating this ambassador, this network internationally where people are going to be fed information about Montreal, what's going on in McGill, what's going on at Université de Montréal, what's going on in different parts of the province, that they can share ultimately and spread the word. And I think that's how we need to leverage communication to be a lot more aggressive about who we are and not be shy about who we are. Maybe I'll finish with one thing. Is that there is a Canadian trait, it's also a Quebec trait. We believe that being modest is a good thing. I think it's a very bad thing to be modest. I think to be humble is a quality, but to be modest is very bad. And I think we need to leverage again the communication that we have today to really promote who we are. Thank you.
Mon tour. Bonjour. I will try to take this subject from my own perspective as a manager of the opinion pages of a major newspaper, because we're really at the center of all the debates, because so many people read us, of course, but more people send us emails and all sorts of communications. It's pretty clear in my mind that it's never been easier for Canadians to express their views, either to political leaders or the government or to the traditional media or to their friends. There are so many instruments, social media, email, and so on, and you can see how Canadians want to express those views. And I'll give you a few examples from my own standpoint. For instance, we try to give in our newspaper and in our web and tablet applications to give everyone an opportunity to comment. So each page or each screen has a button, and people can, you know, touch the button, and the email opens, and they can send their comments. And we are really fascinated by the number of comments we get, but not only the number of comments, but the quality of the comments we get. So people take the time, even when they're reading a tablet, and you know it's not always easy on the keyboard of a tablet unless you have a separated keyboard to write, but people always take the time to write correct sentences and express their point of view. And managing all those emails and so on is very difficult because we have much, much more, of course, than we can publish, but sometimes many hundreds more than that we can answer to in something different than an automatic message. A couple of years ago, we started on a website a sort of a poll where we asked every morning, we asked a question. Many media do this. Each day, we had between 12,000 and 50,000 people answering the question. This is quite extraordinary because, first of all, people know that, you know, their name won't be there, and why is it that they absolutely want their point of view to be counted? It was pretty strange for us, but it's really fascinating how so many people every morning wanted to answer the question that could be, you know, what do you think of this comedian, or will you attend the Rogers tennis tournament, or whatever. But people wanted their view to be known. The government of Quebec, as you know, is looking at all the government programs to see where cuts can be made, and they opened this website where people can send their comments. And it's fascinating, again, to see how many people take the time and go to write, well, I think they should cut this, or I know this program, I know it doesn't work well, or we have absolutely to keep this program because it's essential for poor Canadians or whatever. Again, another opportunity, and people use these opportunities to get their views known. So I don't think, it's true in Canada, it's true in many other countries, people have many, many opportunities to express their views, and they want to use these opportunities. What is strange is that at the same time you see that people feel that government and the elites in general are disconnected, are not listening to them. And of course, governments, like us in traditional media, we track what people say, what they have on their minds. We track the social media, what they say about La Presse, for instance. And obviously governments and political parties do this. They have all these instruments, and yet at the end, people feel frustrated because they have the impression that governments are not listening to them. So that's quite a paradox, and I think it's very difficult to understand. But one, maybe a part of the answer is that we're trying to maybe measure the temperature in the ocean, and suddenly a tsunami happens. You know, there's so much stuff going on that it becomes very difficult to measure exactly what it means. Journalists are big users of Twitter, for instance. But we, during the student strike a couple of years ago, we monitored very closely Twitter and Facebook and other social media to see, you know, how students got their information and what they had to say and so on. And we realized that, in fact, students got very little of their information on Twitter, where all the media were, and were using Facebook much more. That is, they were sharing information between themselves, and the little traditional media they consulted was, again, through what their friends sent them on Facebook, for instance. So it's difficult. We know there's all these sharing of information and opinion, but it's difficult, I think, for governments and political parties and traditional media to know exactly what it means. You know, many people might be angry on Twitter about a particular government policy, but who is it that is on Twitter? Is it representative? It's very difficult. So that's another paradox. A lot of expression of opinion, and yet at the same time, it's very difficult to measure. Is it representative? I tend to think that groups that oppose different policies are much better in using the social media than governments are, for instance. And therefore, each time a government has an unpopular decision to make and to announce, the reaction to that decision is often very strong and amplified by the social media, and governments, for some reason, cannot use the same social media and the web to communicate and explain their decision. And it probably makes decisions by government, when they are unpopular, even more difficult to take, and it might block government action to a certain extent. So there is a very good side to social media, but there's also, let's call it, a negative side at some point. So it's a challenge for us, and I'll leave you with another, I think, paradox, is that traditional media, even though, like La Presse, we try to be ahead of our time, we're very big in technology, we have a very good website, an extraordinary application for tablets, and yet we're fascinated by the social media. And I'm struck by television, when you watch the news, the time they take to tell us what is on the social media. So they always tell us, you know, don't listen to us because we're dull, we're not modern. Go on Facebook to see what really goes on. That's very strange, but it shows again how maybe we're afraid as a traditional media, and maybe traditional institutions are afraid of this monster that we can't really master yet and don't understand. But it's a great opportunity for democracy. We just have to learn how to channel all that energy and understand it better. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. And I just want to start by saying thanks to my good friend Des Morton and others who've done so much to make this institute such a great success. It's made a huge contribution to the country, and it will continue to do so. And the second thing I want to say is that everything John Ibbotson said is wrong. I don't have time. I don't have time to elaborate on that, but I just want to make that very, very clear. I think the best way to, I try to understand what's going on by recognizing that I'm an older person, which is very hard for me to do because I've always been, you know, the youngest in the room, and I'm now 66, so that's no longer exactly the case. That we're in the middle of something. We're in the middle of a big technological revolution. And you sort of have to figure, we're sort of like people were at the beginning of the 16th century after Gutenberg had discovered the printing press. We don't fully understand the impact of what we're living with or what it really means. And what occurs to me is that In the face of all of this expression, and there's a couple of funny things. I mean, everybody has a blog, everybody's on Twitter, everybody's on Facebook, or most people are, more and more people are. It doesn't mean that everybody's equally astute or has something to say, or that what they have to say is based on anything other than just an opinion or a feeling or whatever. So as somebody who's on Twitter and who gets Twitter, it's often a huge barrage of just sort of enormous negativity and personal abuse. And I don't think it's only directed at me. This is something that you just have to live with. So the thing I really wanted to say about where we are is that, and it occurred to me also with the last panel, and particularly listening to Mayor Nenshi, and that is that leadership makes a difference, and that the absence of leadership is a real problem, and that it becomes an even greater problem when you think that your job in politics or your job in business or your job in a newspaper or anywhere is to kind of aggregate all these opinions and sort of say, this is where the wind is going, and so that's where I need to go. And that's just wrong. It just gets us away from the fact that there's a lot that leadership has to provide, and it has to provide it in a much more difficult and contentious climate of opinion. But I think that what's troubling to me is that I don't see enough leadership. I don't see enough. I mean, if you take three or four big issues in the country today, that, and I definitely don't think we're a failed country. I think we're a hugely successful country. But just mention four. One is climate change. Where is the leadership on climate change? Where is it? We've talked about this issue for 25 years. It's been a major issue of public policy around the world for the last decade. And Canada is nowhere on this issue. And we don't have the leaders who are prepared to come forward and say, this is what we have to do. Now, some of the things we have to do are not easy, but they require leadership. It requires leadership to say to people, here's what we need to do, and here's why. And it comes from somebody or a group of people who thought about it and said, you know, we've really thought about this, and this is where we need to go. Just talking to Andre before we got on the show, I'm doing a lot of work now with Native Canadians, Aboriginal Canadians, dealing with resource development in Northern Ontario and Northern British Columbia. I'm working in both those areas. Where's the leadership on Indigenous issues? This is the biggest social issue that's facing us today. It's going to get even bigger in the future. And we don't have national leaders who are really prepared to talk about it because it's not easy and because it seemingly only affects a small minority of the population, but it's a minority of the population that is right at the cusp of the economic future of the country. And we don't have national or provincial or a whole lot of other leaders saying, you know what, Canadians, I know this is number 12 on your list of priorities, but it happens to be a huge issue. And it's something we need to deal with. Where are we on this question of inequality? And the fact that, yes, I agree with Dominic, we have, nous avons beaucoup de mobilité dans le pays, on a beaucoup d'opportunités au Canada, mais ça ne veut pas dire que nous n'avons pas un défi énorme avec le manque d'opportunités pour une bonne partie de la population. Et là, c'est quelque chose qu'il faut continuer de discuter, d'avoir un sens de qu'est-ce qu'on va faire. Finalement, la question du Canada dans le monde, oui, c'est une question globale. Il n'y a plus de frontières technologiques qui existent. Nous sommes dans la même place. What's our place in the world? The estimates now that 500,000 people will get Ebola in the next 6 months. Where are we on this? Where's the world on this? And where's Canada in the world saying, hey, why don't we exercise some leadership here? President Obama at least is mobilizing the army and the Red Cross and saying, we got to do something. You think that's popular? No, it's not popular because it's difficult. You're asking people to put their hands into something that's difficult. It's disease. It's the possibility of all kinds of things happening. It raises all kinds of fears in people's minds. You have to deal with that. And that, I think, is where I come down to this question of, yes, we are seeing an explosion of expression, and we're seeing an explosion of opinion. And technology is now making it possible for everyone to imagine that they have something to say. But none of this takes away from the need for leadership and the need to really try to engage this population that has these variety of opinions and views. And I think that when you look at a really talented and remarkably engaging a figure like Mayor Nenshi, you realize that, you know, we need to clone him and we need to figure out a way to have a whole lot more people like him who get it, who understand what people want and how to get there, not afraid to disagree with his officials, not afraid to break out of the bureaucracy, but is also prepared to engage with the population and say, here's some things we need to do. And I still think people want that kind of leadership, and they want to have it. It's got to be substantive. It's got to be engaged. It's got to be democratic. It's got to be accessible. But it's got to also be based on people having the wisdom to make certain decisions. And I think that's something that we need to continue to push for as Canadians. Optimistic that we'll get it, but we need to continue to push for it. I see.
So I was just going to take a slightly different angle on this question of public expression in terms of just overviewing a few things about how we get access to media and thereby become informed about public affairs. and what that means for sort of social activism, and I'll do it all in 4 minutes and 50 seconds. So I guess the biggest change, obviously, that we're seeing from where I sit is the decontextualization of how we absorb information. So rather than reading the newspaper or listening to the radio station or the radio program, we're starting to access a lot more kind of modular content that's taken out of the context of the overarching media institution. So that's good for helping us learn about our own interests and becoming more deeply engaged in our own interests and our own like-minded communities. But obviously it's bad in terms of having that curated experience of this is what you need to know today. I don't care if none of your friends care about Central African Republic, you need to know about this. So there's a good and a bad aspect to that. As André alluded to, there is this much more social side of how we get information. It really is that sense of it's not what you know, but who you know, in the sense that we are increasingly getting our information based on what our friends on Facebook or the people we follow on Twitter tell us, which obviously is good because that's responding, it's good for us in media because it gives us a sense of what people are interested in, what people are responding to. The negative side of that is that, the business aspect of media means that there's a lot of push towards the stories that get shared the most in those spaces. And the medium, not because people are stupid, but just because the medium tends to privilege certain things. It privileges stories that are emotional, it privileges stories that are visual, it privileges stories that are short. And so that shapes what gets shared. There's a great researcher named Limor Schiffman who's done a lot of work in why things go viral and why they become memes. And that idea of emotional hot buttons, visual things, comedy, all that stuff plays into what gets shared and in turn what our editors value. And implicit in this sort of idea of sharing is the sense that increasingly the information that we get access to is personalized. So not only because it's shaped by the people that I happen to follow who send me links on Twitter or people I'm friends with on Facebook, but also because we're starting to live in the world of the algorithm. We just did a thing about this on Spark last week, actually, which is that you're not getting access to all the information out there, right? The information that you're getting access to is shaped by the algorithms of social media companies. So I don't see what all of my friends are posting on Facebook. I see what Facebook thinks I ought to be seeing, right? And there's an amazing researcher called Zeynep Tufekci who talked about the way that Twitter seems to be moving away from this drinking from the fire hose, just get all the information that comes to you, towards potentially a more of this kind of curated algorithm. And she used the example of the events in Ferguson and how on Twitter she was seeing through all the people she followed on Twitter all this information about Ferguson coming at her. But then when she went to Facebook, where she similarly follows a lot of political people, she was not seeing that information. She was seeing the Ice Bucket Challenge. And that's not because Facebook is particularly sinister, but it's because, per her analysis, algorithms are very good at serving you up things that it knows you already want to see. But it doesn't know that this person is interested in what's going on in the American Midwest because she hasn't seemed to be interested in it before. But this is a thing that human intelligence and, whether that's human intelligence in the social media or whether that's human intelligence in terms of editors, they can say, maybe you don't know that you're interested in this, but here's this new thing that we think you ought to be interested in. And so the danger of all these algorithms is that we get into this idea of what Eli Pariser calls a filter bubble, right? That you're just constantly in this sort of echo chamber of hearing about the things that you already know about and are already interested in. And there's actually some evidence that although social media ought to be these platforms where we can engage in lively debates with people who don't think the same way as we do, there's some new evidence out of the Pew research body in the US, this is American evidence, that the fact that exists in real life, in flesh and blood life, that we don't like to raise topics of political importance when we think that our audience doesn't agree with us, this not only also exists in social media, but it's exaggerated in social media. So in fact, it may be even more the case in social media than in our daily lives that we're less likely to engage in lively debates and more likely to look for that kind of echo chamber. And furthermore, that although, you know, you can get information from anywhere, certainly, there is some evidence that as consumers of online media, we don't get information from all over the world. In fact, there's a study that Ethan Zuckerman out of the Berkman School at Harvard came out with to suggest that for Canadians, anyway, 95% of Canadians studied don't read any overseas media at all. It'd be interesting to know if that is similar or different with Quebec and La Francophonie, but those are the studies for Canada. But overall, on the bright side of that, I would say, you know, that I generally agree with André that, you know, the level of accountability that social media and commenting has brought to journalism, I think in general, has been a very positive thing. I think that I, for one, would not want to go back to where we were at before. But I think the real challenge for us in terms of accessing media and how this affects social activism and political activism is that it's made us very good at connecting with like-minded individuals. I feel like I've learned a ton about my neighborhood from Twitter, but I don't think it's done a great job of connecting us as a country or necessarily even connecting us as much as a global community in the way perhaps we would like to think that it does connect us.
I get the first round of questions, but I'm asking, and we're asking all of you to send your questions via Twitter with hashtag Canada Remix. Donc, vous pouvez envoyer vos questions par Twitter. Moi, je vais lancer le bal avec les questions. Je vais commencer avec Dominique, parce qu'en entendant les autres commentaires, et surtout Nora à la fin, vous avez parlé beaucoup de l'importance de sortir le message, d'avoir un message, et que ce message soit capable, finalement, d'attirer une auditoire. But how do we... What is the message, first of all, and how do we, how when you're developing a message, for example, for Montreal International, how do you make sure that you don't fall into an echo chamber?
Good question. So, so first of all, I think we need to be, I just came back from Asia, and I was in Tianjin, and Tianjin is 15 million people. I'm thinking, as I'm driving down in Tianjin, I'm thinking, two Tianjin equals Canada. And we're such a small country in terms of the population. We really need to get ourselves organized. And when we are organized, we really perform well. So when you talk about like the way we convey a certain message, I'll take the example of talent. In certain areas in Canada, and in Quebec in particular, we are missing really key strategic talent. We did a mission that we organized a few months ago. And we used the social media to attract the people. We had 300 jobs that we didn't have people for. We didn't have enough supply in Quebec to fulfill those roles. We went internationally. We had a total of 13,000 applicants for those jobs. 13,000 applicants, and 3,000 of those were via social media. And when we talk about Canada and we really understand what are the things that we really we're going to target, we talk about the universities that we have, we talk about our strengths, we really send a key message of what our strengths are, I think it does work. I'll give you another example. When we looked at all the projects of investments that they wanted to go abroad, so people from everywhere in the world wanted to go abroad and invest in a country. And 6 times out of 10, when Montreal was shortlisted, when a person came to Montreal, saw Montreal, and really engaged with Montrealers, 6 times out of 10, they would decide to come to Montreal to do the investment. So I think the conversion is great when we're actually communicating, but you have to tailor the message. You have to tailor the message to the talent group. You have to tailor the message to the right audience. And I think when you engage with the right people, the talent, you start creating this momentum of people willing to come here. 13,000 people applying, it's sending a good noise like in the system. Then you start building some momentum. And think of all, like we are in McGill today, think of all the foreign students that are here that are not from Canada. What are we doing specifically to welcome them, to keep them, to talk about the opportunities? And that's also how we're going to start creating leadership. We're talking about leadership that we're missing, but this talent pool ultimately is going to be the pool from where we're going to see, hopefully, leaders emerge and get going with some of those issues. And I agree with Barbara, we have a number of issues that we are facing. So.
Sur cette question de leadership, ou au moins comment on fait l'interface avec, dans l'expression démocratique, André, vous avez parlé du tsunami de l'information, mais y a-t-il des gens qui sont à l'extérieur de ce tsunami? Est-ce qu'il y a des gens qui se font noyer par le tsunami? D'autres termes, how do we make sure, or do we know, if people are outside of this echo chamber or twittosphere are actually having or making their opinions and voices heard as well in the democratic process?
Well, we know that there are people outside because we know that some people are not on social media or have tried it or not liked it. We know, for instance, that Twitter, even though it's very present in the newsrooms and so on, there's a small group of people who use it a lot and that it's not representative of public opinion. Facebook is different because people can use Facebook for whatever they want. They can keep it very private and their family and friends, or they can, you know, talk politics and build a political community of people that agree with them or things like that. So it's to me, what is really fascinating is what will happen with all this. And for instance, I'll give you my personal example. When I started Facebook, to me, it was an opportunity to have other people know what I'm thinking, what I'm writing, and give me feedback on this. So everyone that asked to be my friend, I said yes. But I ended up with so many friends who actually were not sharing anything that I wanted. They were sharing things from, you know, their private life, the meal they had, and a picture of the spaghetti they cooked. And so it became unmanageable. And besides, I got very frustrated at the fact that Facebook was deciding what I was going to see. And what strikes me today is that when you make detailed surveys of how people see the world and so on, one information that always comes out is that people want to be in control of their lives. They want to decide what they, and they don't want government to decide for them and so on. Yet with Facebook and other social media, they accept to give up control of what they see and what they read to an algorithm which they don't understand and changes all the time. And I'm just wondering whether this, combined with concerns about, you know, confidentiality and so on, may in the end weaken the model of Facebook. We're not seeing that at all now, but there's sort of a paradox and a contradiction. So it may be that even Facebook becomes a very active and yet maybe not a majority of people being on Facebook. So, and polls that have been used traditionally, as we know now, are less accurate than they were. Even though people want to express their views on all kinds of media, when the poll company calls or sends them an email, the percentage of people participating is going down. So again, I'm coming back to this. We know that there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of expression of opinions. Some of them are trash, but most of them are interesting, and yet we don't know where public opinion really is. So in my view, it's a tsunami, and it comes back to leadership. I think it's probably more difficult today to be a leader and to face this tsunami and decide, well, even though this is what the tsunami tells me, I'm going to go the other way, or try to convince the tsunami to stop and veer right. I think it takes a lot of courage, and I'm not seeing any political party now or leader in Canada that has that kind of courage.
So Bob, leading off from what Andre just said, are democratic institutions still equipped to do the job of representing and leading, given this tsunami, given this revolution?
I think all of our institutions are really challenged at the moment. I think every one of them, and I think it's partly because that it's not just a technology. It's also the comparison I make is that, you know, when I was younger, when I was a kid growing up, you're watching television, you had to physically get up and switch from one channel. Switch from one channel to the other channel, right? And now, if you're sitting watching television and you have 500 channels to choose from, and if you don't like what you see, you flip it off. That's sort of like what's happening in politics. You know, oh, we're tired of that face. We want another face. So let's get another face on. So bingo, you're toast. Somebody else is coming up, and let's see what they have to offer. But it's true everywhere. I mean, we live in a time that's very little deference. There's a lot of, I think, disengagement that's hard to read. We see it in the polling. We see it in the lower participation rates in politics. You see it in the dramatically lower levels of participation among people under the age of 30. And if you don't get people to vote by the time they're 30, we don't know what that wave is, what that group is going to be like when they're 35, 40, 50. You know, we don't know what that leads to. And that level of disengagement presents a problem. And I do think that governments are cumbersome and bulky and, yes, bureaucratic and have difficulty changing, but so do a lot of other institutions. A lot of other, you know, big organizations have difficulty coping with the impact and the speed of change. Somebody was saying, well, a university enrollment goes down 20%. Well, that's huge. And that institution will have to change very quickly. And if it doesn't change very quickly, it will be facing extinction of some kind or another. Merger, amalgamation, something else will happen. So I think it's not just, I mean, there are real problems with the way Parliament operates, and you know, I could go on for a day about that, but I won't do that. But Parliament is not working effectively at all. And question period doesn't work effectively, and accountability within government doesn't work effectively. And the way politicians message now is ridiculous. Nobody can give a speech. Everybody has to read their messages. And if you were to have somebody here who was in office or who was in, they would use this opportunity to deliver the message that their team had met at 9 o'clock in the morning and said, this is the message of the day and these are the words you have to use. As you can tell, I was never very good at that. but it is a diminution of debate, exchange, dialogue, all of the things that we value. A conversation, a real discussion, a disagreement, and then, God forbid, you change your mind because somebody's actually persuaded you. I mean, these are all the things you'd like to see in a democratic conversation. So if you say, what would global expression be like? I'd like to see one where, the prime minister was willing to go to the UN, and yes, it's a big talk fest, but he'd listen and come back and say, you know, this really is an issue, and we got to engage as Canadians, and now let's get on with it, and here are the choices that we face. But you don't see any of that. You just see this kind of rote repetition of a single propagandistic message on an hourly basis. And that makes for political dialogue. And I think that's terrible. And I think it's a real problem for the quality of our politics today. And not just in Canada, but it's everywhere. And it's a huge problem.
So this.
Where were you when I was running for office?
Many of them were right behind you. So Nora, this dearth of new ideas in public debate or in democratic debate, and yet this tsunami of information, you who study this for a living, are we better or worse informed today?
I think both. I mean, I think that is the thing, that I think in some respects we are grazingly informed about a lot of things, and we probably know, we have the ability to know very deeply about very specific things. But I think the collapse there has been in the well-rounded individual and the politically engaged, well-rounded individual. My friend Kathy Bond likes to say that, you know, the intellectual is gone and now it's all about geeks, right? It's all about the niche level of knowledge and information rather than that kind of well-rounded depth. But I do wonder just when we, I mean, maybe it's possible that we're still in this process of learning and that part of the question of like leadership and vision comes down to thinking in terms of have both and rather than either or. You know, some of that top-down kind of leadership, but also the tremendous vitality that that's offered to us by the spontaneous bottom-up generation of political ideas and notions via social media, or God forbid, you know, in the town square, as we saw in Mayor Nenshi's speech, that potential for people to actually, if they feel empowered, to actually go out and do something. So I think it's possible that we might still be in the early going, and that maybe we can find a way to do politics a bit better, so that it's not either leaders or just, you know, everybody press yes or no on their device, but that it becomes something a little bit more a little bit more nuanced and a little bit more in the middle. I mean, one thing that we see through social media is when there's a crisis that happens, right? When something like the crisis in Haiti happened, suddenly you saw these people emerge as these kind of hubs of credibility, you know, that it wasn't necessarily that you were looking to politician X or media expert X, but maybe there's this person who is in Port-au-Prince who is a hub of authority that emerges almost spontaneously as a leader within that kind of mode. And I think it's possible that we can learn to get better at harnessing those kinds of things that we naturally see happen in situations of crisis when we're not in a crisis.
I want to end with a question from Twitter, but one that also comes back to the first panel. The first panel ended on an optimistic note by talking about optimism. I'd like to ask the panelists, what's the solution to what we've sort of uncovered here as this problematic in terms of the echo chamber on the one hand and the dearth of leadership on the other? So is there a solution? Is it about reforming institutions? Is it about thinking about new institutions? Is it about rethinking social media or thinking about what's the next big thing in social media? What is the solution to some of these problems? Y a-t-il une solution? Autrement dit.
Y a-t-il une solution? Je crois qu'il y a différentes manières de regarder les choses. La première, c'est que dans les médias, il faut qu'on trouve un moyen d'utiliser... Les gens sont désengagés dans la mesure où more people know about a lot of things. They're very aware. But once they decide, you know, they click the button, like you were saying, they feel that they've contributed to a cause. And that's enough. That's what engagement is all about. And I'm concerned about the way we convert, we translate engagement by clicking on a button, by being on Facebook, etc. And we believe that by doing all these things, we don't need to vote anymore. By doing all these things, we don't need to be engaged in our organizations, and we think that change is going to happen by simply doing this. And I think we need to change that. And I think it starts very young. When I have my children, I go with them. They're 5, 6 years old. I take them on activities, and you really push them to really get engaged physically in things. And that's one way of thinking about it. But also, we also need to collectively challenge ourselves. Monsieur Ray, vous parliez de leadership. Important. Il y a des questions qui sont importantes. Par exemple, les questions en matière d'éducation. Puis je pense que c'est important de le soulever à McGill ici. Qui, aujourd'hui, parle vraiment de problèmes d'éducation? We have, for example, when you think about secondary schools, we have 30% of people leaving primary schools, going into secondary schools, that don't know how to read well, how to write well, or both. This is a fundamental issue for Canada. And how are we going to find the leadership to do this? And I really believe that those questions are really essential, and we don't necessarily tailor them in the when we need to. So part of me is saying need more leadership in some areas, and part of me is saying we need to channel social media into action, find a way to convert this into actions.
Moi, je suis plutôt pessimiste, pas pour le Canada, mais je dirais pour la démocratie libérale traditionnelle. Il n'y a pas de responsable particulier, je pense, de cette situation, mais le niveau de méfiance à l'égard des institutions est extraordinairement grand. Et je pense qu'une des raisons pour lesquelles peut-être on a des leaders faibles, c'est que les leaders forts ne sont pas nécessairement acceptés. Les gens résistent beaucoup quand quelqu'un dit « voici la direction où il faut aller ». Et les gens veulent des leaders, mais quand les leaders arrivent, ils n'aiment pas trop ça non plus. Alors, et puis les médias participent beaucoup à ça aussi. Alors, les gens veulent qu'on fasse quelque chose sur les changements climatiques, mais il ne faut pas que ça leur coûte plus cher, puis il ne faut pas qu'il y ait de péage sur le pont Champlain non plus, puis il faut pas... Bon. Alors, moi, je suis inquiet parce que je ne vois pas non plus de réforme de nos institutions, par exemple, qui pourrait satisfaire le besoin que la population semble avoir. Et je pense qu'on est dans un cercle vicieux. Moi, je crois profondément à la vieille démocratie libérale où on élit des gens et puis ils essaient de faire leur travail. Puis au bout de 4 ans, si on n'est pas content, on change. Mais au moins, on leur laisse un espace. La démocratie dans laquelle on est maintenant, la rapidité de l'information, les médias sociaux et tout, fait que c'est impossible. Le gouvernement est constamment prisonnier d'une opinion publique extrêmement capricieuse. Alors moi, ça me rend pessimiste. J'ai peur que nos institutions soient bloquées et incapables de résoudre certains des problèmes qu'on a. On le voit aux États-Unis, on le voit au Canada. M. Ray parlait des Autochtones. Au Canada, on a des richesses naturelles formidables, mais on ne pourra pas aller au bout de l'exploitation de ces richesses-là si on ne réussit pas à s'attaquer au changement climatique et à résoudre nos difficultés avec les Premières Nations. C'est deux conditions fondamentales si on veut vraiment devenir une superpuissance énergétique. Je ne vois pas dans le système politique actuel comment un gouvernement peut vraiment s'attaquer à ces problèmes-là sans soulever la colère populaire. Alors, je pense pas qu'on puisse être pessimiste pour le Canada en général, parce qu'on est un pays très riche, mais je pense que pour notre démocratie, la solution, en tout cas pour l'instant, je la vois pas honnêtement. I'm sorry about this.
I guess having been in public life for a long time, to me, optimism is kind of a good working principle. You know, it helps to motivate yourself. It helps to motivate other people. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's true all the time, because there are some big issues. And I guess I just come back a little bit to my sense that it's very hard to understand something when you're in the middle of it. And I think, I've learned a lot just listening to people. I mean, I've learned a lot about algorithms and how Facebook works and how Twitter works and all that other stuff, which is all part, seems to me, of part of the education that we have to go through and have to try to understand. We have to try to understand better the nature of the technology around us, the impact that it's going to have. And use the phrase of Marshall McLuhan, we have to understand media, because it's the air we breathe and it's the culture that we're developing, and there's no getting away from it. You can ignore it, but... And you can pretend that it's not really there, but it is having a significant impact. But it's not a force in the abstract. It all relates to people and how people respond to these institutions, these technologies. And the thing that troubles me is I'm actually a big believer in institutions. I believe that, they're really important, and that renewing them and making them work better is essential, and that you don't just create one big public space, you create a lot of different spaces for people, and that's how things have always worked best. And I think the real problem that I have with the technology that exists today is it forces a kind of privatization of behavior. It makes it harder to really engage people, because people go off into their bedrooms and wherever, and their living rooms, and watch the computer and do this, and they connect, and they don't necessarily go outside and connect with everybody else. And so it doesn't create more public space, it creates more private space, which is good in some ways, but also means that, we have less engagement. I mean, the people don't sit around the dinner table and have a meal anymore. It's families don't necessarily spend a lot of time talking to each other. When I think of my own growing up, there were lots of moments when those were very significant moments of conversation with my parents and my brothers and sisters to talk about things. And you know, if the family isn't able to create that, then you've got some problems and issues about how people will behave in the future. And I think that's something that we need to think about.
I suppose I'm by nature a pessimist, but in some senses I'm not. You know, one of the things we do a lot on my show Spark is we talk about how we can do better at technologies, right? And so I think on the one hand, I think part of the solution is getting the tools to be better so that we're not so stuck in these kind of filter bubbles. And, you know, there are technologists who are really actively engaged in trying out these kinds of things, trying things like 20-day stranger. You know, follow somebody who lives in a completely different part of the world from you, who has a completely different life from you. There are little experiments. They're trying to build that sense of being more open and more open-minded. But I think if there's something individually that I think we can do is just to, you know, to make a promise to yourself that you're not going to, that you're going to do what you can to get outside of that bubble, whether that's, you know, actually, God forbid, being out in the street more, or following people and getting access to points of view and information that are radically different from your own instead of just what your, you know, usual cohort of Facebook friends think. I do, on the optimistic side, I do feel very optimistic about what I see people do in my local community, on the neighborhood level, on the kind of micro level, where I feel like the chance for reinvigorating is to take that beyond those neighborhoods and local communities and, you know, making it bigger, giving us a bigger heart and a bigger passion around around those kinds of values. How we get there, I don't know.
Thank you. Dominique has the last word.
I just want to quickly say, I don't know how we cannot be optimistic when we look at 30 years ago and today, and how many people are less poor today than it was 20 years ago. If you look at the progress, I think we have to trust ourselves that historically we've done better. We had phases where, you know, we went through war and we did things that had impact the rest of the world. But fundamentally, we have improved. And André, vous disiez tout à l'heure que les gens n'aiment pas nécessairement le leadership fort. Mais je pense que le leadership fort qu'on voit à Montréal aujourd'hui est très bien accueilli parce que, justement, on n'a pas eu de leadership pendant des années. Et que maintenant, heureusement qu'on en a un parce qu'il est à peu près temps qu'on s'organise. People were talking about who's going to vote for Prime Minister Nenshi. But we have some leaders that people are willing to follow. Il y a des initiatives intéressantes, open budget, où on peut aller voir, les citoyens peuvent aller s'organiser. Ce n'est pas encore des outils qui sont parfaits, mais je refuse de croire que collectivement, on ne va pas être capable de faire mieux. Et je refuse de croire que les gens ne reconnaissent pas de leadership fort quand ils le voient. On peut critiquer internationalement des leaders comme Angela Merkel, mais la réalité, c'est que Angela Merkel, pour l'Allemagne, a réussi à quand même tirer son épingle du jeu. Donc, au pessimisme de l'intelligence, j'oppose l'optimisme de la volonté d'avoir des gens qui veulent vraiment faire des changements. Et il faut se faire confiance par rapport à ce qui s'est passé par le passé.
Great message for the future. We started with disaster and community. We went through tsunami. Positive message to end. This part of the question period comes to an end. Not that question period, Mr. Ray. This question period. But I want to thank you all the panelists this afternoon, for having been so generous of their time, but also of their ideas, and talking to us in what is a traditional forum, obviously, to those of us in the room, but reaching so many other people as well through social media as you've been speaking this afternoon. Je veux vous remercier chaleureusement, Madame Anglade, Monsieur Pratt, Monsieur Ray, et Madame Young. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you.
I'd now like to ask Denise Chong and Lily de Grandpré to come up to the stage to say some closing remarks. It's been a wonderful afternoon in all of your company for this 20th anniversary, and we'd like to ask the outgoing co-chairs to end the day.
Merci, Antonia. J'aime beaucoup le mieux le terme outgoing que ancienne. On n'est pas si ancienne que ça, Denise et moi. Enfin, on a fini notre mandat le 31 août et ce fut un plaisir de travailler avec toi, ma chère Denise. Et aussi d'avoir suivi l'exemple de Charles Bronfman et d'Alex Patterson. On avait des co-chairs qui nous ont précédés, qui avaient un talent extraordinaire et qui nous ont montré la voie, comment faire pour la suite. Alors, merci.
I would also like to thank all of the panelists. I think
We've talked about leadership, and I think it was true to me that the 8 panelists, plus our 2 moderators, I wouldn't want to forget, Antonia and Ken, were true leaders in their community, whether it was business, arts, Mary and all of her work for the Aboriginal community, because we are truly blessed as a country in Canada, but we have not managed to share it with everybody. And I think that's probably one of the key challenges that faces us moving forward. But I'm a strong optimist. I'm a strong believer in leadership. And I think that the example of Mayor Nenshi was extraordinary, because if Calgary was able to deal with the problems they had, it was because of his leadership. So thank you to our panelists. Merci beaucoup. Et puis Denise.
Thank you, Lily. When we conceived of this event for to celebrate the 20th anniversary and organize this symposium, we also organized a fundraising campaign. And we began last spring with a goal of $2 million, and we're past the halfway mark. And the idea was that we would hope to endow events like this. And this is the public education part of the mandate of MISC. These events, which normally we would list on the back of programs and you'd have the list of your sponsors, what we hope to do, in fact, is instead of lurching from one event like this to another and going after sponsors, was to hopefully endow events like this so that people of Montreal and those watching on the live stream could know that they would have these sorts of public education events that are housed within the university but reach out with equal enthusiasm outside the university. So the event that we had this afternoon, I think, exemplifies that mandate of MISC. It draws on the strength of the diversity of Canada, the power of the diversity, to bring together different voices, put them on a national stage, have national conversations, bilingual conversations, to bring light to issues, to spark ideas, spark debate, spark collaboration. And so if you're like Bob Ray and said you've learned a lot about something today, or if you in the audience go away from today or events like this and think about Canada in a little different way or understand something a different way or your thinking has changed a little bit, then I would argue that already you've changed the world. So I'm going to make a last word, which takes me back to raising why we began this fundraising campaign and why the friends at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada are going to dedicate themselves to bringing this endowment to fruition. And why do we have events like this? And I'm going to close on this. Because Canada matters, and because being Canadian matters. So thank you very much for coming to this afternoon.
Bye-bye. À la prochaine.